Weekly World 117.
She's just 117. You know what I mean.
It's never straight up and down.
It's never straight up and down. It's never straight up and down. It's never straight up and down.
Whoa. Sorry about that. Wiggly World. Hey, everybody. Oh, it's been wiggling. It's not been wiggling. Different things have been wiggling. But what a winter. Wow. I mean, I think I've been illin' ever since I got back on the ill wagon, as the kids say. Ever since we got back from our wedding, like the late October. And I just think I haven't been able to shake this. It's been really something. And every day with this flu, and believe me, the flu was happening for the last We Talk Games. In fact, we have a We Talk Games coming up here. I need to get stuff together. I need to get people on the horn. And I'm still like, you know, And that's sort of why episode 12, January's episode, opened with Stinky, and there was that play that happened. Hey, if you don't listen to We Talk Games, you don't care about video games, at least listen to my horrible play that Stinky wrote. I don't know why I say mine, I mean Stinky. And Stinky and TT start doing this horrible play, and I don't know, you know, what that's all about, but... that's quite early on in the beginnings of We Talk Games 12. Just go to wetalkgames.com. Our name is our address. And listen to that episode 12, at least the beginning, even if you don't do the video games. But why not stick around for the rest of it? Because I talked to Trip Hawkins, and then we have the Super Mega Council form. And there's also a survey on wetalkgames.com, the upper left-hand corner. Click on survey. Now, you can only do this every 6 months. It's about 90-some questions. I think it's 50 questions. It doesn't take too long. It takes, like, I don't know, 3-4 minutes at tops, if you're a slow reader like me. But it'll help me get some information on our listeners, what would be better if you've never listened, things like that. So even if you're not listened, go to wetalkgames.com, upper left, click on survey, and please do that for me. I appreciate it. You don't get any money for that, and neither do I, but I get information that can help me make a better show, make better products. But back to this flu business here. So I can barely talk. I guess I sound okay now, but even that episode 12, I had to try to do a voice. I had to go low. Fortunately, a lot of the things were already recorded, so... When I actually had a voice, and I lost it sort of right after we got done recording. I've been to the doctor. There's just so much to talk about. I don't really feel like talking about myself. I'd like to get on to topics. It will be free balling, and believe me, it will not only be free balling Friday. It will be all over the place Friday, most likely. He gave me, first of all, this doctor... It's the first time I've seen now. It's the first time I've been to a doctor in 6 years. And I went to 4 doctor's offices whenever it was that I went. Oh, Tuesday. That's why I didn't get to do a show. I went like at 8:45. I was supposed to be done at, you know, like 9:15 or something, I thought. But I didn't get home till like, I don't know, 1 o'clock or something like that. It was silly. It was ridiculous. So I go to this doctor, and it's the first time I meet him. And, you know, that's fine. It's okay. But I went to... There's 4 St. Luke's on my street. And, of course, I didn't make this appointment, so I didn't know where I was. I had Chiz call because, you know, I got to tell you, just to sidetrack right away, everything, immediately. With my disorder and with my load of work, oh my gosh, I don't even want to start talking about that. I mean, it's, I didn't get started with I'm 4 hours late starting with this because I had a emergency code, some ActionScript 3, you know, Flash 9 stuff. Why am I even doing this? Okay, here we go. The doctor. So there's four St. Luke's right on my street now. And I asked Chiz to do it because one thing I'm not good with is business hours. I am well organized. I put everything, you know, in front of me. I'm ready to go. I'm good to go. I get a high volume of work done in a remarkable amounts of time, in my opinion. But one thing I'm not good with is calling people during business hours. So I'm not good at setting appointments. I'm not good at, you know, getting in touch with people during business. They need to be open 24 hours, just like I am. I work 24 hours. I need, you know, doctor's offices to be open 24 hours so I can set up appointments like that. So I asked Chiz to call me because it was getting ridiculous. Every time I felt like I was getting better, even now, I feel like, you know, 2 days, I'll be jumping around doing cartwheels, which I do anyway, but I'll feel better when I do them and boogers won't come out. But I wasn't even having boogers. I had this pinch down in my throat. It was this pinch. And I had this pinch, and then all of a sudden, it was like, And I'm not really stuffed up, but now I am towards, you know, a month later or whatever. I'm starting to get stuffed up. I wasn't before. It was just like a terrible sore throat. I would lose my voice. And I guess this is all, you know, common stuff for flu and virus and stuff like this. So I finally figure out which doctor I'm supposed to go to after the third office I went to called around and found out. And I got there and, you know, I set up and I do my thing and my mind's totally fried by then. I don't know who I am. I don't know what's going on. Just much like right now, I feel I have so much before me and so much to talk about that I don't know what I'm doing. So I talked to the doctor and he says, well, you know, you should get a tetanus shot. Out of nowhere, I'm talking about the flu. He wants me to get a tetanus shot. Now, one thing I am not is a vaccine denier. Like vaccines don't do anything. They only get people sick and all this other business. But bullpup. Okay. Many diseases probably were aided in decreasing because of the advent of vaccinations. Now, you can you know, look over these studies yourself, pro and con. But definitely things like the flu. If I would have gotten a flu shot, I doubt that I'd be like this right now. You know, I am a strong advocate of if you do not get the flu, the seasonal flu shot. I'm not talking about the pig flu. if you do not get the seasonal flu shot each year, then you're probably, Chris Jericho says, a germ incubator. You are incubating these, the flu, the viruses and things like this. So get your flu shot and then you can build up a tolerance to flu and probably won't get it for as long as I did. And I should have gotten it and I didn't. Once again, the business hour dilemma here. I have to get on that. And once I can get back on some meds, Lamictal, I think, is what I take. Once I can see some type of psychiatric evaluation person and try to get back on those things, I know that'll calm my brain down enough to be able to function more like a normal human and be even more creative than I am now because I won't have 13 zillion things flying around simultaneously to distract my creativity. But this guy says I need one of these things here for stepping on a nail. Tetanus shot. Is that what I said first? I don't even know. I hope that's what I said. So I said that I need a tetanus shot. Now, one vaccine that I do not think is relevant any longer is a tetanus shot. Because from what I've read about tetanus affects people that do not treat an open wound. And they just let it fester, and it's damp. And then the tetanus can go around in there. And then they get lockjaw. I guess that's one of the symptoms of it. You get lockjaw, and then you die eventually. But this is from my research in the past, and I talked to him. I said, I thought basically that really only affects people that don't treat a wound. And the most common case of this, the most common people that die of tetanus that I knew of at the time and hadn't researched since then, were normally the elderly that are in, an elderly assisted care facility where they're not really being cared for, and all they do is lay around in bed all day, and then they get bed sores and no one treats them, and it's, they're still laying in bed, the bed sores are moist, and then it gets infected with tetanus and then they die. So that's what I thought. And then, I talked to the doctor about it. I said, well, look, I don't want to tell you. You're the doctor. You tell him. He said, no. Like, you're a young guy. You're working on a car. You get a cut, and then you get tetanus, and then you. I said, well, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, okay, as long as he doesn't say if I step on a rusty nail, then I get it. And then I said, well, you're the doctor. He said, no, go ahead, tell me. And so then I, proceeded to continue on with my understanding of it. And he said, no, it's like if you step on a rusty nail. And then, so right then I was like, oh boy, I'm going to probably get a second opinion after this. But, I got the tetanus shot. That's no problem. I'm not afraid of it. It's not like it's going to do me any harm. It's just going to probably make my arm sore for a couple days. So I got that, and evidently the whooping cough, and I don't know the technical term for this, is making a resurgence. Now, whooping cough only really is dangerous to children, babies, infants mostly. And he asked me, did you plan on having kids or anything? And who knows what can happen. So I got that as well, because that's for a couple years. So I got those two things, but, I a little bit of sour taste. And I came home and I researched it and some more. And indeed, they do say that, tetanus can colonize, I guess, on rusty nails, but it could be on any steel. So, but I still, I have to do deeper research into it. That's not the real point of this. The point is that he said, listen, I'm not going to put you on antibiotics because you seem like you're going to get better soon. And I said, well, that's what it's been like for the past, month and a half. I feel like I'm going to be better in 2 days, and then I'm not. He said, well, if you needed antibiotics, you would have been dead by now. I'm going to put you on these benzonate capsules. And he says, now you just swallow these. They're going to be little gels. So I thought, great. I'm going to be eating gelatin, whatever. Which, I try not to do. Well, I don't do. But I don't really know what the inactive. I don't even want to look. But it says. But he said, now you're going to take these beads whole. You're not going to chew them. You're just going to take them whole. So I said, okay, no problem. So I went to the pharmacy, and the pharmacist, I guess, evidently no longer tells you. How the side effects, what to do. Well, I guess they'd be sitting there reading a dictionary if they told you the side effects of medication. But this was supposed to be for my cough. Because even though I feel pretty good and pretty, chipper and spunky and all that, if I cough every now and then, I feel like I'm going to die. I feel like I don't feel like I'm going to pass out. I don't feel like I'm going to throw up. I just feel like walking death for some reason. Deep down, horrible, shutdown feeling. So he gave me this thing to help my cough. Once again, playing into the conspiracy theorists that, physician, modern medicine only treats symptoms. It doesn't treat the cause, which is just pure, totally ridiculous. If you have a broken leg, you go in and, or like your appendix burst or something like that, They don't treat the symptoms of a fever. They don't give you an aspirin because you have a fever from your appendix bursting. No, they go in there and they fix it up. And there's you know, to say that that modern medicine only treats symptoms is just pure conspiracy bunk. But, you know, here we have it with this doctor prescribing, you know, here, we could stop your cough. There you go. And it doesn't stop it. I don't even know if it curbs it. Hopefully it does. But anyway, he said, you know, you got to do that. So the pharmacist gives this to me, does not tell me, you know, don't chew this, just swallow it whole. They don't tell you anything anymore, evidently. They just say, they just look at your insurance and they say, okay, go. Oh, by the way, the reason that I got to go see a doctor again is because when I married Chiz, now I'm on her health insurance. I haven't had health insurance for the past 6 years. So there you go on that. If you're new to this show. So he gives me these benzonate capsules, and the pharmacist does. And I bring it home, and I read it. It says, take 1 to 2 capsules every 8 hours as needed. Chew or suck, it says right on it. Take 1 capsule, 8 hours as needed. Chew or suck. That's what it says on the label on the thing. Not on the big pamphlet, not on the side effects area, not on the thing. And I was like, you know, here's this doctor telling me about tetanus, rusty nail, and now he's telling me to just swallow it whole, don't chew or suck, and it says right on the label, chew or suck. And of course, you know, this is how I read things. Horribly. So I put one of these capsules in my mouth, and I'm sucking on it. And it gets pretty loose, and then I give it the old chomp, and the juice squirts out all over my mouth. And immediately, my tongue starts falling asleep. My tongue starts going numb, and my throat starts going numb. I'm like, what the hell? And I look at the label again, and I turn the label slightly, and it says, 8 hours is needed, do not. And then on the next line, chew or suck. So the way I was holding the label and the way I read, it says to chew or suck. I showed it to Chiz the way that I read it. She read it exactly how I did, chew or suck. And then I started reading the side effects. Can cause choking if you chew this and suck, because your throat falls asleep and your mouth, your tongue falls asleep and everything. And I guess you could, you know, choke. So I'm like, oh my God, the first time back, and now I got to call, you know, the poison hotline and everything. Well, I didn't have to. Everything's good. There's 15 minutes all down the tubes. But I'm trying to get better, and I asked for psychiatric references. I don't know anyone in the psych field. That's what my doctor said. That's lovely. So and we'll find out. So that's what's been going on there. Chikara has been nuts. The new Go-Go's take me approximately 4 to 5 times as long to edit each episode and to put each episode together, because they're composed of, you know, interviews. This next one coming up, we're going to have 2 interviews. The Gavin Loudspeaker and the King of Trios special update, and 2 clips plus our regular in between bits. That's 6. Well, then the regular in between bits, it's another 3. So that's 8 different parts plus the beginning and end that I just, you know, stick on. And then the lower thirds I have to blow over on that, the transitions. I mean, these things are monsters to put together, even though it's the same, you know, 8-9 minutes. It looks like nothing. There's a lot more going on, because each one of those little interview segments get treated. It, you know, I know it probably doesn't look like anything's going on there, but first I have to sync the audio up from the better H4 audio recording device, which, once again, is in the shot of all these newer Go-Go's. You can see it on the right side this time, my H4 recorder. Thank you, Kahura. By the way, February 7th happened. Wow, I got to talk about that. So these Go-Go's are just taking forever. And then plus, I have the regular interviews during the week to release. This is silly. And then today I put up another secret little thing. If you don't know about coupon codes and things like that, might want to try to look into it. Get a Chikara yearbook, and you'll find out all about these coupon codes and stuff like this. Because it's fun. It's fun little things like that that are neat that happen. But that's coding, and it took me well over 2 hours to decode the latest one because I haven't done Flash in so long. And something very uncommon on a Mac, when I went to launch Adobe Flash, and Adobe just, I don't know what they're doing. They're out of their minds. But for some reason, Flash went open. I had to reinstall it. So it's very unusual to have that type of thing that occur on a Mac. But that is indeed what happened. So that took even more time. And then figuring out how I did it before. Because, you know, I try to hide files so people can't just type in, you know, a secret word or something like on a web and find these things. They're all just random numbers put together. So it's all quite difficult, especially for me, because number one, I hate ActionScript 3, I hate Adobe Flash, and I wish it would die. But February 7th came and went this year. It was a lovely celebration. It wasn't huge. It wasn't gigantic. It was very, very nice. I got a couple books from Wrestling Man. And while Noel Malinowski, again, just, you know, you can't out-nice this guy. You can't out-nice this guy. I sent him, I don't know, Shakespeare or I sent him a $12 book off his Amazon wish list. And if you don't know about February 7th, it's a holiday that I came up with, I don't know how many years ago, 4, 5 years ago, or maybe even 3. I'm not sure. Maybe it's only like the third year of this. I don't really recall what year we started this. But then it was really propagated and moved on by people like Kahura, who, you know, really clung on to this and this idea and this concept. And I got a letter from John. He celebrated February 7th, Johnny Capcom, part of We Talk Games. And he had a blast with it. His friends are asking, you know, is this based on ancient things and stuff like this? And it's awesome. But it's a day of media. And the reason that it's on February 7th is kind of not very exciting. I used to try to do unique things with a show I was involved with called Smart Wrestling Fan. And on that show, you know, it was a weekly show about pro wrestling. So, you know, I tried to spice it up a little bit, tried to make do some interesting things. And I think I've eclipsed those things with what we do now when We Talk Games. But, you know, every show I try to bring in, I try to, I don't know, do something special with it, you know? Make it not like every other thing that's out there. What reason would you have to tune in? Except for this show. This show, I just sit and talk. So, this February 7th, we were going to do a show, and we were going to do it on February 7th. So, I thought, you know, it'd be funny if I just mentioned the date, and then I have a jingle that goes, you know, February 7th, as if that means something. And then the next year, it started to mean something. Because February 7th, it just kept, I don't know, it was catchy, and the jingle was. It was just saying February 7th, that's all it said. And it was a prefabricated, license-free music clip from the GarageBand, Apple's GarageBand. So it caught on, and then we started to breathe mythology into this thing, and we made it a day of media. So you can give media on this day. And even if you don't have money, you can, you know, make someone a mixtape. You can give someone something that you really valued. Any type of media, book, recording, song, create a song for somebody, create a mixtape for somebody, or whatever the equivalent is now today, you know, make a CD or something. And, you know, movies and things like this. Anything related to media. And lemon cake. For some reason, I don't know why. Lemon cake, some type of lemon pie, lemon meringue pie with whipped cream on it. That's probably why I got the lemon cake, because lemon meringue pie with whipped cream on it is something that, you know, Humphrey Bogart said to Bugs Bunny back in old Warner Brothers cartoons. And for some reason, that always stuck with me. I've had lemon meringue pie many times. In fact, I had it this past February 7th. It was great. I got a half pie at the Giant. One of the saddest things you could ever see, the half pie or the single slice of pie. That's even more lonely because you don't even think you're going to eat it more than once. And maybe I'm going to die tomorrow. I'm just going to get the single serving pie in its own individually wrapped blister pack. So I got the lemon, but I've never had lemon meringue pie and then put whipped cream on top of that. So I just think that's so funny. So that's how the lemon tarts, lemon bars, lemon cakes, lemon, anything with lemon or even citrus, if you don't care for the lemon, is acceptable as some sort of the honorary dessert of February 7th. So we had some delicious Archway lemon cookies and everything else. It was a very, very yummy February 7th. I got Chiz a book on deep sea animals, which it's amazing what we're finding now. And there was a great show on one of these channels, maybe Discovery or something, or maybe History. I don't know. And believe me, History's really... All these channels are getting under my nut, number one, because, you know, they keep propagating this ghost business as if it's, you know, History ghost, you know. Well, remember when the ghost came on television and said, hey, we're the ghosts, we're going to be here. And then they wrote a book. The ghosts themselves wrote the book. Ghosts don't do anything historical, you know. Showing up, I don't consider that history. So even, I mean, even the people that report ghosts, which are just people seeing things that are just tricks of light, tricks of their mind, raccoons, things like this. Even those people, they never see a ghost doing anything that's worthy of history. You know, ghosts don't do anything of historic importance. Okay, so they shouldn't be on History Channel. And it shouldn't be on Sci-Fi, and it shouldn't be on anything else. Well, I mean, maybe as a movie, but not as a hunter. These hunters suck. Put me in there, in the ghost house, and I'll show you. Because number one, when we go to investigate a ghost, and someone comes up and say, hey, we're haunted, you know what I'll say to them on the telephone? Just get a close-up of me in HD on the telephone saying, well, I'm sorry, there's no such things as ghosts. You must have been mistaken. Goodbye. And that's the end of the episode. You know, it's a 15-second episode. But you know, these great things on the sea, they estimate that we've only seen 2% of all ocean life. And it's amazing. So this giant book of ocean life is gorgeous because it's nothing but giant photos of all these things I've never seen before ever. You know, it's amazing, how much is out there. And you know, we never see a ghost of all these fish that, I mean, fish outnumber us by, I don't know how many. Ants outnumber us 1,000,000 to 1. For each one person, there are 1,000,000 ants. Why aren't there like ant ghosts going crazy? Going bat crap crazy, you know, anting around, whatever they do. Humans are amazing for removing themselves from their environment, that just believing we live in a vacuum. We're not a part of our environment, you know. It's amazing. Just look around, and things don't add up if you try to, pigeon these silly things into it. But, of course, I'm completely off track again. There we go. And speaking of off track... Any letter that is more than a month old, I have stashed in a pile somewhere, and I truly, truly apologize. I have a few letters here before me, and I'm going to do those, and I really apologize. I'm going to find them, and they're important to me, but I seriously have gotten so much dumped on me in the last 2 months that I don't know how to get out of it. I don't know how to get out of it. And there's also the thing with the house, and that fell through because our independent investigation inspection of this proved to be that this thing should have never passed gotten a clear CO of this house that we're going to move into. Needed a lot done to it, and we took those to the seller, and they refused to invest into these repairs, so we walked away because it would have been far too much for us to do. And it was very interesting because the other agent working for the seller said, "Well, you know, don't contact the city of Easton. What do you want done?" So, isn't this interesting that this house was on the same block that at the end of this block, the mayor of Easton lived? So, it sounds like somebody got something pushed through there, because the city of Easton, they're very strict on their inspections, and this thing got a clear CO, and there was a lot wrong with it, safety issues and everything. So, a little suspicious, but we walked from that. So now, you know, there's drama going on about that with my love of my life. She's sad and everything else. So a lot going on in the Wiggly World. But February 7th turned out to be a hit, and Chizzy loved the book. And talking about, so back to Noel. You can't have nice. And by the way, I don't know if you listen to this show, Cohor, but I mean, I tried to go through my list of people that I know and have donated to the show, and I tried to look for their Amazon wish lists, and I didn't see many of these people. I didn't see yours, Cohor. So Cohor, you know, you've done so much for the Go-Go, so much for me, so much for all the shows over our their existence, that I really wanted to try to get you a little February 7th something. So if you do have some type of wish list, please email me with that. Hey, you know what? You know what the great thing about February 7th is? You can celebrate any time during the year. And I wanted to get everyone a February 7th jingle. I wrote the whole thing. And you might already know the lyrics if you, you know, paid attention. But that was going to happen, and then I lost my voice. So it was all bad. But a cyber power UPS showed up off my wish list from Noel, and wow, this thing is amazing. It's a UPS power backup. This is something that I really needed in my coupe here, because my new Mac really can't survive off the old UPS. I think I had a 350, the popular brand of APC, yeah, APC 350, which was could not handle the power supply of this Mac here. So when I would turn on this heater in my room, my computer would shut off, and then it would go beep beep beep, and I would lose, and everything would lose. So now I can actually turn on my heater with this thing plugged in, and this cyber power, it's quite amazing, and it's quite gorgeous, and it's only at 19%, and I have a G5, a Mac Pro, a large monitor, and a couple of my hard drives that I don't want to shut off in the middle of power loss. So this thing's amazing. And then a few days later, I received my Ashbury bass that was also on my wish list. So I had to give that guy a call right away. You just can't out-nice this guy, and that is amazing. I've already, and I never had an Ashbury bass. I saw it and I thought, this looks really cool. But I got it, and the fretboard is unbelievable. It's only like a 2-foot fretboard for a bass that's really, really small. Now, I thought this was a smaller style bass, and that's cool because I've played smaller neck basses, and I could really fly on those. But this thing is really mini. It's almost micro, but it's fretless, so that's amazing. And the strings are made out of like rubber. They're rubber band type of bungee strings. I've never seen anything like this. And it's really, really cool. So it doesn't lend itself to a lot of the songs that I've written before. I mean, I guess if I practice like a crazy person, I might be able to play some of the older songs, but it would be difficult. I would have to change where I play them on a registry. But it does lend itself to all new ways of moving my fingers and my hands around. And I can play it, and I can fly on it. And I've written like several new, just riffing around, cranked out a couple new song ideas. So I'm really, really looking forward to laying some stuff down with this thing, this Ashbury bass. It's really cool. But What a guy, what a guy. And on my own note, I picked up the Hercules DJ. I thought I had some type of sheet here with it. The Hercules DJ, that's what it's called, right? Hercules, yeah. Control Steel, that's what it is. Hercules DJ Control Steel. And this is a USB device that you plug into your Mac or PC, and you use a virtual DJ software, and then you can, you know, mix things together better. You can do all different types of cuts on three different megahertz ranges of your sounds. So, you know, you could do some really, really cool things with this. And this is because I'm going to be DJing a wedding coming up, and also to help out with the Chikara shows. Because the Chikara shows, when you're playing entrance themes and you're just using iTunes and you're trying to double click on a song to make it play while you're trying to fade down the other fade, you know, you almost have to be left-handed or be sitting on the proper side of the board. It's very difficult. So now I can just press a button, and, you know, I have both tracks queued up. I just press a button, and the other theme song will start. So no more flubs there, and I can also build set lists pretty easily. And then you load them in, and I've been practicing around with it. It's going to be pretty great, and it's definitely going to be very useful for doing that wedding. And I hope to get more jobs like that than after this wedding. I think that people will really like what I bring. Also, if you checked on WigglysWorld.com, I did an upgrade to our message. What do you call that? The boards, right? The bulletin boards. PHP BB, I did an update to that, and also to the mini chat. But if you go to WigglysWorld.com, you'll see that I have the charity for Humanist Charities. And right now I have the Haiti Relief Fund on there, which I assume is still going on. And now you can donate through a humanist organization. And very shortly, pardon me, I think I will just change this to just be a link to the Humanist Charities. And in this way, you can donate without any type of proselytizing going along with your dollar. Now, I'm not saying that any organization proselytizes or does anything such as that, but this is just pure, secular humanist type of humanist charity support link. So you can just be a human and not have to have any strings attached to the donations that you will be donating. Okay, very good. Now, this is something I don't like to see. We're almost 40 minutes in, and I don't know what I talk this about myself. Let's talk about Lakeeta Garth. This lady, if you want to see the most annoying lady ever in the history of humankind, most annoying human alive, look up Lakeeta Garth. There's so many things about this person that will rub you the wrong way. But I'm really jumping ahead. I really don't want to go there. I want to talk about something a little more important than some celebrity that self-righteous celebrity. And I'm going through my email. I think I need that Lamictal. Sooner the better. I actually have a We Talk Games interview coming up quite shortly as well. So this is all getting far off track. The reason that I really wanted, the thing that's really boiling my bubbles recently, among other things, is let's talk about Louisiana. Let's talk about the Super Bowl. What? Yeah, that's right. Let's talk about the Super Bowl, because that'll all lead into what we see going on. First of all, the Super Bowl commercials. What? If I was an advertiser on this thing, number one, who'd be great? They're true entertainers. Too bad it's only two people. I guess that's 50%. What are you going to do? It's sad. It's too goddamn sad for me to watch, because I just love John Entwistle so much. But that notwithstanding, Pete Townsend's still an entertainer. I mean, his shirt was getting, his jacket was getting in the way of playing the guitar. But who cares? Don't sacrifice good sound for entertainment. And he's still entertaining. Plus, he knows what it feels like to be a woman. So there you go. That's also a good thing. Because the Super Bowl commercials were laden with things that were anti-woman, pro-man. I don't want to wear a dress. If you know, I am a man. I like television. I need to have mobile television because women would never want to watch television anywhere except from, you know, under a cabinet in the kitchen or something. Why didn't they just come out and say some of this? It was horrible. This is horrible, wasn't it? I don't know what's going on here. Man, I'm a man, and I'm proud of it. But that's not what I'm really upset about. If I had paid those millions and billions of dollars to advertise, I don't know, did it reach a billion? I'm not sure. But definitely millions of dollars to advertise. And I had my commercial that I spent a lot of money just to make the commercial. And then I spent a lot of money to get the commercial to air during the Super Bowl. And then my commercial's theme was the same theme as every other commercial shown during that segment, I would have been incredibly outraged. Like, we had, you know, here's a football player tackling a regular person. Then the next commercials, you know, Snickers. Here's a guy tackling Betty White. You know, regular people getting tackled by football-y people. And then, you know, here's one that that stars, you know, people that are only 2 feet tall. And then another company, the people are only 2 feet tall. And another company, the people are 10 inches tall. They grouped together liked themed commercials. I would have been outraged if I spent all my money and had my idea right next to another company with a similar idea. Now, why is Wiggly talking about Super Bowl commercials? Because one of those tackles that went on was a football player tackling his mom, I think. And then it was all white and it was all clean, squeaky clean. And then the graphic came up about, you know, being nice and being good and doing the right thing and stuff like this. And lo and behold, you find out who this commercial is for. Focus on the family. And I about crap my load pants. Right in my sandals as well. Because if you don't know who this Focus on the Family is, they have a DVD. And it's quite humbly entitled, The Truth Project. DVD-based curriculum for living out a Christian worldview. They have Jelly Telly, promoting biblical literacy through fun shows, songs, games, and more. Yo-ho-ho, cut off my baby's penis skin, slap it on my husband's penis. Then God will leave the bar and spare us because I'm married to the bridegroom of blood. Jelly Telly. Be a voice for life, tools and resources to help honor all stages of life. Plugged in. The plugged and then an apostrophe N. Trustworthy reviews of the latest media and entertainment releases. Well, they're already so trustworthy in the way that they freaking sub... in a subterfuge, but they disguise themselves as something that they're not. Adventures in Odyssey, exciting character building audio entertainment for the whole family. Adventures in Odyssey. Oh, look at the Odyssey vault. Oh my gosh. Hey, Super Bowl fans. If you didn't know, this was supposed to be an abortion commercial. And it was supposed to feature that football player. His mom was actually having an abortion. She was giving herself an abortion in an alley with a coat hanger. And as the blastocene comes out of her womb with the hanger, the football player was going to dive and catch the ball before it hits the ground, lateral to one of his teammates, and then they were going to score a touchdown and spike the blastocene. I just made that up. But it was supposed to be an anti-abortion commercial, and I guess they decided, well, actually, we want people to come to our website, so let's try to make it look like, hey, we're really hip and with it and fun and relevant to today's youths. And of course, you can only have marriage, you can only be a parent, you can only deal with addiction if you are a Christian, and you can survive an affair if you're a Christian as well. And these are the only ways, really. Let's watch Jim Daly, the president. No, let's not. But this focus on family evidently has enough money to do this. I'm not sure if it really ties in with the Australians' report on earthquake survivors get solar-powered Bibles from correspondents in Miami. AS International Aid Agency rushed food, water, and medicine to Haiti's earthquake victims. As International Aid Agency rushed food, water, and medicine to Haiti's earthquake victims, a U.S. faith-based group is sending Bibles to Haitians in their hour of need. Not just any Bible. These are solar-powered, audible Bibles that can broadcast Holy Scripture in Haitian Creole to 300 people at a time. Called the Proclaimer. I had walked 500 miles and 5 foot walk 500 miles. The audio Bible is delivered digital quality and is designed for poor and illiterate people. The faith comes by hearing, group said, which is all capitalized, so that leads me to believe that's some type of trademarked. Faith comes by hearing, some type of trademark. Any student of the Bible, anyone that has read the Bible, anybody that studied the New Testament, studied what's written in there, and I'll of course get into whether you believe that this is a culmination, a joining, gathering of Christology, of the Christ myth. Of the mythical Christ, whether you believe that there's a teacher underneath this, a human that taught things, it was a teacher that suffered for his preaching peace and stuff like this and celibacy, which is probably why if anyone was persecuted for this, they were probably persecuted because they were telling wives not to sleep with their husbands, but that's sort of left out of a lot of people's history on the suffering of early church leaders and stuff like this. No matter what you want to do, if you take the New Testament as a whole and you somehow try to breathe in a multi-million dollar commercial during the Super Bowl and solar-powered Bibles to people that need clean drinking water and medicine and medical attention and food, and you try to somehow make this Christian, this solar-powered Bible, you somehow try to... If I was a Christian and if I followed the teachings of the New Testament, I would be outraged at this gross, just complete waste of money being thrown into solar-powered Bibles and freaking Super Bowl commercials. I would be outraged. Let me take a drink. Now, how did I know about Focus on Family? How did I know about it? Because, I care about this type of thing. I'm concerned with the role of powerful Christian movements infiltrating government, becoming part of governmental policies. Ever since the Dover trial, Dover, Pennsylvania, and that trial was so liberating as a person that is concerned, that cares about the Constitution, that cares about, you know, our Declaration of Independence, cares about anything to do with freedom in the United States of America. this is of great concern to me when some types of powerful religion motivated groups try to influence and infiltrate and use deceitful tactics to get their agendas passed and permeate the government, our government. That's about it. I got nothing. So I know about Focus on Family. I greatly know about the Discovery Institute. I know about their agendas, and I know about the TEA. I recently read a great article in Skeptical Inquirer. Let's see here. Skeptical Inquirer, this is volume 34, number 1, January, February 2010. So check it out. It has a very good article about the wedge strategy update, intelligent design creationism since the Dover trial. The Dover trial was a great series of events that really showed that the Discovery Institute was simply repackaging creationism and trying to pass it as a science with the ID movement. And unfortunately, where it failed, and we had a very conservative judge in Pennsylvania that ruled that this was nothing but religion disguised as science. And there was no science to it. And threw it out, and not only threw it out, and didn't throw it out, he ruled against it, but not only did he do that, you know, he did so in a very angry and degrading way towards the people that were trying to pass it, and as it should have been. The people that were trying to pass this as science need to get, you know, more than just said no, no, you know. They need to be punked out, exposed. And that's what happened. But now we see in the TEA, we see in the LFF, the Louisiana Family Forum. Now I'll just read from this article in Skeptical Inquirer, Academic Freedom ID Style. We're talking about the attempt to pass the Louisiana Science Education Act. Louisiana Senator Ben Nevers stated frankly that he introduced the Louisiana Academic Freedom Act on behalf of the Louisiana Family Forum, LFF, a Focus on the Family affiliate, because they believe that scientific data related to creationism should be discussed when dealing with Darwin's theory. See, their data... their scientific data, the Focus on the Family, the Discovery Institute scientific data should be discussed when we're talking about this wild-eyed theory. Of course, I'm reading into it, but that's sort of what it comes off to me. CSC fellow David DeWolf helped craft this law, and CSC staffer Casey Luskin accompanied expelled victim Caroline Crocker to Louisiana to testify for it. After a legislature passed a renamed version of the bill with only 3 dissenting votes, Governor Bobby Jindal signed the Louisiana Science Education Act, LSEA, on June 25, 2008. The LSEA requires Louisiana Board of Elementary and Secondary Education to allow and assist teachers, principals, and other school administrators to promote critical thinking skills, logical analysis, and open and objective discussions of scientific theories being studied, including, but not limited to, evolution, the origins of life, global warming, and human cloning. Now, isn't that novel? I stand behind allowing teachers, principals, and other school administrators to promote critical thinking skills. I'm very much behind that. The problem is that this is a huge deception. You know, they don't want to promote critical thinking skills. They want to say, you know, This theory of evolution that Darwin had, and by the way, it's a scientific theory, which means that it's more than just a guess and an idea and a concept. A scientific, gravity is a scientific theory. Now, you could say that gravity isn't real. When I drop an object, it's because the Earth is moving upward. The flat Earth is moving upwards, and X forces acting upon it instead of gravity. And the gravity only affects things not on Earth and other crazy flat Earth believers, things I thought I'd sprinkle in there to further confuse everyone. But this is not what this is opening. This is not saying we want critical. The critical thinking is already in science, okay? Science cannot be anything but critical thinking. Well, it can be if it's done wrong. But science cannot be dogmatic, okay? Of course, if you listen to, if you watch Expelled, you could think it's dogmatic, but it's not. There's no dogma to be happening here. You can accept what other people have researched, but you are always encouraged to disprove it, to prove it wrong. That is the scientific method. Proving things wrong, developing experiments to prove it wrong, is what science is all about. Okay? So there can be nothing but critical thinking in science. There can be, but then it's being done wrong, like I said. This is simply to open it up for the science of creationism, and I'll get into that, and that's the whole reason I was so, I had such a boner to get on here and talk about this today. It goes on here, global warming, other things that they want to deny, through the use of supplemental textbooks, and human cloning, great, through the use of supplemental textbooks and other instructional materials. The law includes, and believe me, this is citing, this is citing references all along, but I'm leaving it out so that we can understand what I'm saying here. The law includes an almost verbatim restatement of the Discovery Institute's telltale religion disclaimer in its model statute. Nothing in this act shall be construed as promoting any religious doctrine, promoting discrimination for or against a particular set of religious beliefs, or promoting discrimination for or against religion or non-religion. Now, you can say that sounds great too. That sounds great too. These guys aren't dumb. I mean, maybe their beliefs are, and once again, I'll get into their science after this. But definitely, their law is not dumb. You know, they've made enough mistakes over the years to know how to craft this and disguise it. This is just, they're saying, listen, we don't want to exclude anyone's religion here. But, and it's a real shame that Bobby Jindal, was born Hindu, was raised Hindu, and then converted to Catholicism. You know, they would not, if someone would come into a science class and start teaching the Hindi idea of creation, I'm sure that there'd be people picketing. You know, I'm taking my kid out of school. Believe me, this is an agenda here. This is not, there's nothing being disguised here. In fact, how can it be disguised here when, Senator Ben Nevers states right there that, on behalf of Louise, that they believe that scientific data related to creationism should be discussed when dealing with Darwin's theory. He's right there stating that he wants that these scientific... maybe we should just get right to the science right now. Why dilly-dally? But let me finish here. However, LFF... Yes, discrimination against a particular set of religious beliefs are promoting discrimination for or against religion or non-religion. By including other theories and bills, the bill's author tried to deflect accusations that evolution was being targeted. However, LFF operatives have routinely addressed only evolution in their public comments. Furthermore, analysis of the LSEA's historical provenance and terminology demonstrates that it is a creationist bill written in identifiable code language, using such terms as academic freedom, critical thinking, logical analysis, and open and objective discussions. The code terms of choice in Louisiana have traceable creationist origins. In addition, the LFF, whose missions is to persuasively present biblical principles in the centers of influence, has promoted creationism for almost a decade. Has the LFF. And it currently promotes creationist textbooks, textbook addendums, and the Discovery Institute's DVD teaching modules. Now, I like to think of myself as anything but a conspiracy theorist, but I seen that those millions of dollars spent by Focus on Family, seeing this legislation passed, seeing Sarah Palin being paraded around every news channel for the past month or so, or 2 months, this to me we're not in the clear on the religious right trying to impose policy changes. And you know, listen, I know that the majority of politicians are Christians in the United States. That doesn't bother me at all. You know, people have faith, people have whatever, people believe in all different types of things. No one believes exactly the same things I believe, and I know that. Everyone's individual, and there's all different types of reasons why people believe in certain things, and I don't have a problem with that at all. I do have a problem with, and I realize that, you know, that people's backgrounds are going to influence their decisions. There's no way I'm going to be able to take Christianity. I mean, expect Christianity to be taken out of people's decisions in politics. Now, that would be silly. Because, you know, I'm all for understanding, you know, how people do things, why people do things, if they ever question things. Why don't they question things? Things like this. You know, I understand there's going to be influences. I know there's going to be money influences and stuff like this. So, believe me, I realize this. I understand. But I do take exception when people try to say that, you know, the United States was based on the Christian principles and things like this, where it wasn't. Most of our founding fathers were deists, which means that they believed that there probably was a creator of everything, but that creator, once they were done creating, definitely had no concern with being any type of personal god or personal savior, and really didn't care what man was doing with himself down below at all anyway. He might have put it in motion, but he certainly didn't interact with these lowly ant type things. They were deists. They believed that something, there might have been a god out of there, but it really didn't interfere with human life. And this is why, you know, I mean, listen, these were people that still had slaves, okay? They still believed in that some people were less of a person because of their gender and because of their skin color, for Christ's sake. You know, these were people that had some effed up values and morality. Not all of them. You know, some of them knew that was wrong, and they tried to overcome that. They tried to make it right, and they spoke out against it. But even though that they were so screwed up like that morally, like the Bible is, you know, allowing for slavery, and even you know, setting down laws on how long you can own a slave for, and what type of slave you can own, and you know, how you, if you do rape your slave, that's okay because it's your property, but then you have to marry her, you know, those type of things, because then she's still your property as your wife, you know, all those good biblical values. Now, even though these people you know, didn't get it right on women and people of a different color and ethnicity being the same as them, they did write in these rules about separating church from state. I mean, that's, you know, taking religion out of politics was something that they did write in there. I guess they considered that to be more offensive than you know, understanding that discriminating against people because of their gender or race was a bad thing. So they even thought that was a worse evil. Than those other crazy things that we of course sanely look down upon now in today's culture, and thankfully we do, you know, but we still haven't gotten it right. There's still so much wrong. It's sad. It's silly. It's hard to believe we're in 2010, and you know what? We're not in 2010. It's hard to believe that we're here. As humans, almost, I don't know, you know, we can trace human culture, we can trace these, what we might call humans back several hundred thousand years, perhaps some would say a million years as a communal animal type of thing. But, and speaking of fish, I mean, these are communal creatures, huge communal creatures, far predating human civilizations, far predating our communal attributes and things like this, and far exceeding them. So definitely the largest culmination of communal creatures is in the oceans. And indeed, if someone from another planet would come here and they would look down, they probably wouldn't examine human civilization, human culmination, human collectives. They would probably look at sea creatures that far outnumber us and are far more communal and probably get along a lot better. But here's the bottom line. Should other theories of evolution be taught? Should other theories of how we got here as a human race be taught? And we're speaking about humans. We're not talking about what fish do. We're not talking about what the ants do. And what they teach about how they got here and how they praise God and say a silent prayer every morning after they say the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, I'm not talking about that. Now I'm back on humans, okay? Should other theories of how we got here be taught? Sure, why not? Well, what are the other theories of how we got here? What are the other scientific theories, I should say? Because, I mean, that's what we're talking about here. Everything that's been presented, all is under the auspices of science. And it's talking about science classes. It says here, allow NSS teachers, principals, and other school administrators to promote critical thinking skills, logical analysis, and open and objective discussions of scientific theories being studied, including, but not limited to, evolution, blah, blah, blah. So, scientific theories being studied. What other scientific theories? Are there competing scientific theories other than the theory of evolution? Well, there were scientifically competing theories in the day of Darwin. There were, you know, people that... This is hundreds of years before genes were discovered and having an important, I don't mean blue genes, Vidal Sassoon and things like this. I mean, you know, your genes, your G-E-N-E-S. And, you know, this is before DNA and everything else. So, yes, there were a lot of other competing theories. Now, we can observe evolution, but that's not what they're talking about here. They're talking about Darwinian evolution, and I know that, okay? So that's what I'm going to try to deal with. Perhaps there still are scientific theories of how we got here. But I can tell you one thing that I know that is not a scientific path of investigation, and that is creation, creationism, okay? There is not one single bit of scientific evidence pointing to creationism, that God created the earth. Okay, there's zero evidence of that. There's zero scientific evidence that anyone can point to, and I'm not, maybe in the future they will. There's zero scientific evidence that God created the earth. In fact, if we use the Bible, and we can show how God could not have created the earth, and if he... I'm sorry, I'm adjusting my pop filter. And if he did... Now I gotta get mad again. And if he did create the earth, he did it in a real cockamamie way that doesn't gel with what we know about reality and how shit works, you know? He's a complete bonehead if he did create the earth. Because it's all backwards, and it's all, you know, the sun, after the first, second day, after 4 days of day and night, then he creates the sun. And the sun is this own unique thing that's quite different than the stars. You know, the stars, of course, they only twinkle. The sun is a big ball, so they got to be different. You know, he really should have made things a lot better. You know, anyone that reads the creation story in the Bible, or anyone that's never read the Bible, if you're a Christian, if you never read the Bible, and the year is 2010, and you say, okay, you know, I'm gonna start reading the Bible, and if you start at Genesis, and I've done this in previous episodes of Wiggly World, and if you start at Genesis, you're gonna say, well, no one really believes this, right? I mean, I'm still a Christian, you know, yeah, because, you know, Jesus is cool. You know, he's hanging on a cross, his abs. And, you know, he's got the blood going on. That's kind of cool. He's sort of like emo, you know, sort of like a goth or something. It's cool. He's blading. You know, you think he's kind of cool. I'm still a Christian, but no one seriously believes this. This is you got to be kidding, you know, right? You know, there's just so much wrong with Genesis. And that's the only thing, the only science that creationism is based on is the science of my mom told me it was true. This thing keeps falling. Hallelujah, Holy Spirit. My mom told me it was true. That's the science. If you look under a microscope, it says, my mom told me it was true. If you do cosmology, yeah, look at the stars through a telescope, my mom told me it was true. That's the only proof of creationism. Someone's mom told them that this was true. Now you may point to irreducible complexity, and that means that when you get down to single cell organisms and multi cell organisms rather, and organisms that are so complex that they could not have come about through natural evolution, then this points to proof, like this siphon thing that. Behe was talking about and stuff like that. Now, the problem with irreducible complexity is, number one, there is nothing that has yet to be found that is so irreducibly complex that it could not come about by natural evolution, natural selection, and the constituents of that. Once again, irreducible complexity, I think I didn't explain it properly, but I think it's the organism is so complex that if you take away a piece of it, it no longer can function properly. I know I'm murdering this, but it no longer can function properly. You know, every piece has to be in place, and if you took away a piece of that, it wouldn't be a viable, and there was no reason for it to evolve that way, et cetera, et cetera. It had to have been created. Now, even if there was something that was found that was irreducibly complex, and believe me, so far there's been nothing. And that's what overturned the Dover trial, was because we showed that Behe, that there were other uses for this siphon things, even if you took out very important parts of these organisms, that it could still function and could still be used for something. And it does show that it was not irreducibly complex. And then I know he's doing some other stuff that can also be refuted as well. And that's all what science is about. That's cool. That's good. That's going on. I'm glad that people are looking into it. But so far, there's zero science. But even if there was something that is irreducibly complex, which there isn't so far, that would prove nothing as far as a creator being involved. It just means that now we need to figure out how something that is irreducibly complex can come into being. Okay? It doesn't prove at all that God put it there. There is no scientific evidence. There's no scientific proof. There is no... I mean, there's theoretical arguments that people can say work, like logic puzzles and things, but even those logic puzzles have way around, which are an incredible bore to listen to and can take like 20 to 30 minutes to try to examine these logical puzzles. And all these are just, you know, it's pure conjecture. It's pure talk. It's abstract. It's poetry, you know, really. Some of these psychological examinations of these reasons why God must exist, it's pure poetry. It does, but it's nothing scientific. It's nothing that you can create an experiment to prove or disprove. There's zero scientific evidence for creation, and that is why creation should never be taught in school unless some type of scientific test or scientific theory is real and can be introduced. Creationism is solely based on "my mom told me so, and I'm not going to question it." That's what she believed. And you know what? She might not have even really believed it, but she wasn't going to question it. I mean, I guess we can invoke that great scientific mind, a great theologian of theological studies, the great the person that brought us that wonderful movie Expelled, Ben Stein, and you know, it's right in there. It's almost like saying "my mother told me," because Ben Stein, I mean, I saw him on a interview show when he was promoting Expelled, and honestly, that's exactly what he said. He said, when I was a kid, everyone knew that God created, and this is a perfect imitation. When I was a kid, everyone knew that God created the earth, and everyone just knew that. And then when I got older, then people are saying, "No, he didn't." And I'm like, "What?" And I said, "Uh-uh." And then I made a movie because I couldn't believe that people used to all believe that God created the earth, and now all of a sudden they don't. So I said, "No, he did." And believe me, that's verbatim. I'm reading a transcript here. No, I'm not. But basically, that is what he said. You know, he said, "I was shocked. And when I got older, people had different ideas and didn't really believe all the stuff that my parents told me was true, you know. They're actually questioning things." So that's my little rant about creation science. I've seen these creation science museums. Well, sure, they show Adam and Eve walking right there with dinosaurs. You know, that is science. You can't dispute that. You walk in a museum, and they have Grand Canyon there in 1/32nd scale or something, I don't know what it is, And it says that, you know, this was carved by Noah's flood in about 7 seconds, the entire Grand Canyon. How can you dispute that? It's science right there in a museum. But, you know, I don't know if anyone told Ben Stein or anyone else's, but having a museum doesn't mean that your theories hold any water or are substantiated by any proof. I mean, you can go to Lady Trousseau's wax museum and see, you know, Jack the Ripper and everything else, and it's a wax museum. I saw Captain Kirk. I stood on the bridge of the Enterprise. That doesn't mean that Captain Kirk is real. I mean, he's awesome, but you know, this is based on mythology as well. It's not scientific to prove Captain Kirk and Spock exist. I can't prove that they don't exist. That doesn't mean that it's scientific. I can't prove that Spock and Kirk don't exist in real life. I mean, yeah, I know that, you know, it was a Gene Roddenberry production. It was on television. It didn't do so well. Yeah, it did okay. It ran for several years, 1 year longer than I think that their mission was for, or something like this. This is off the top of my head. You know, I know all these things, but I can't scientifically prove that they don't really exist in real life somewhere out there, and neither can you, and neither can anyone. But that's a piss poor way of saying it, that they scientifically exist. I mean, we have methods to show that the Grand Canyon wasn't cut in 7 seconds. And we have methods to show how the Grand Canyon wasn't made at the time that Noah's flood was supposed to be made. And we can come at that from a lot of different angles. We can come at that from geological methods. We could come at it from anthropological an approach. We can do carbon dating. We could do so many different scientific, known, tried, tested scientific methodologies to try to pinpoint, you know, how long the Grand Canyon has been around, approximately when it was formed, what layer was formed when, what type of environment, what type of climate was going on at that time, what was the indigenous plant life. We could even come at that through biology. I mean, there's so many different ways we could come at that, but none of them show that this happened when the flood happened. And, you know, and Noah's animals are floating down a Grand Canyon, for Christ's sake. Pardon me. It's so infuriating that, you know, people, this is a desert myth. This was a very localized tribal desert myth, friends. And, you know, it preceded the biblical story, that's for sure. It was definitely a Babylonian story as well. It was a Sumerian story, the flood. These flood stories were very indigenous, tribal, local. And people that went, that were seafaring, they told the story when they went into different ports of call and things like this. So this was making its rounds, in the Middle East, you know. This was a very common Middle Eastern myth. But there's absolutely zero evidence to show that the Earth was formed in 7 days, and that plants were around before the sun was on, and all these, and then you can say, well, God can do anything. Well, then why did he do it in such a dumb way? Contrary to how we know things work through photosynthesis and everything. Yeah, he could do anything. Under that premise of God being able to do anything anyway, you would get rid of everything. You would get rid of the need for a Lakita Garth. You would get rid of the need for freaking Pat Robertson and his hate. I really think we need to start a petition to deport Pat Robertson. I mean, I'm all for freedom of speech. I think it's incredibly important. I wouldn't be able to say the things I do say in some parts of this world. Other parts I would be more encouraged, I think, and more prominently featured, perhaps. But definitely, Pat Roberts is just a spe- spewer of hate speech. He is an embarrassment to the population of America, and even his most devout followers, I think, cringe. But I think he says things that are inflammatory, and you know, that's once again protected our freedom of speech. But I think he goes beyond that. I think he goes into the areas of stupidity, and of course, once again, you're able to be stupid in America. There's no law against that. But I thought this out more deeply previously. Now it's lost to me as to the reasons why. But I think just as a consensus, as a general consensus, I think we should start a poll, maybe on Facebook or something, to deport. I don't know where we would deport him to. I mean, who do we want to really give this guy to? But I would like to see he's free to say whatever he does, but I would like to see us deport Pat Robertson. I just think he's just a horrible, horrible human being. Do you know he almost got elected to, like, run for the Republican Party. I mean, this is insane, this person. solar-powered Bibles. I mean, this guy said, you know, Haiti, look what he said about Louisiana. Sinful. That's why God may kill people. People are dying. People are dead. Children. Innocent people. And this is nothing new. I mean, you know, the Bible speaks about running through the crowd, spare no man, woman, child, elderly, make your blood run. I don't know, it uses terminology that it's like proud to drink the blood of thine enemy. Leave only, but spare those with the mark. Spare those with the mark, which was, of course, the mark of the cross, which was... But this predated Christianity. I was talking about the Tau, the letter T. Spare those, but, you know, kill everyone else. What was that, in the vision of Ezekiel? Yep. And I guess that's why we do, like, the Ash Wednesday and stuff like that. Hey, but, you know... Whatever, Pat Robertson. So I saw this Lakeeta Garth. How did this all lead to me looking into Marilyn Manson? I don't know. But then I saw Marilyn Manson on an episode of... I watched the Pat O'Reilly thing. And I saw him on there before. And I thought he did a good job. And mostly that was, you know, talking about the same crap that comes up, blaming media for... children killing people and stuff like this, and you know, it's absurd whenever these type of things happen. But you know, he spoke very well for himself. I think I would have handled it a lot better. And I've always been kind of down on Marilyn Manson, only because, you know, complete jealousy. And I was a big fan of Alice Cooper, so I'd seen all this before. And the other folks that he may have influenced him as well. So I've always been a little, you know, jealous of him, because I would love to have been shock rocky type of innovator. I was doing electronic music, back when he was still just reaching puberty and stuff like this. So. Or before, maybe he was a little kid. So I got on and watching him and just trying to listen to him. And I've heard him speak before, and I've seen this Pat O'Reilly thing before. I never saw him on the Bill Maher. On there, he was okay. But one of the other people was this Lakeeta Garth, and she was just so incredibly annoying. And I don't think there's anyone more annoying than someone that just... She's a type of person that just can I don't want to say retelling. I don't want to say ripping off. All she does is not think and formulate something for herself, her own ideas. She just reiterates and quotes and can cite verse. So she does do some processing. You know, she's intelligent on some level, very intelligent on some level. She could do things I certainly can't. I can't quote scripture verbatim as she could, but that's all she does. She only parrots what already exists, someone else's ideas, but she's able to correlate that to what is being said to her. So she knows enough to, she's intelligent enough to know that, okay, we're talking about this, then I will quote this scripture. And so she makes that abstract connections. However, she doesn't formulate ideas for herself, and she can't see. She's quite good at pointing out, well, you don't read your Bible then. You don't know your Bible. You don't know your Bible. It's as if she doesn't have the floodlights on to know that the Bible is really a niche thing, you know. It's not for everyone. There's people out there that, of course, have never read the Bible, and many of them might even be Christian, who knows. But she doesn't seem to take into consideration that there's 30,000 sects of Christianity. That means that all those people believe something slightly different, even though that they may quote and be able to quote the Bible themselves as well. But they believe something completely different and at odds with what other people believe. And then, let alone the other, you know, several billion people that believe something completely against what she believes. But all she does is just keep quoting and quoting and quoting and not really thinking about what she's even saying, nor does she quote, you know, the things that might make her treasured Bible look like the hateful, insane book that that the naughty bits might, you know. So you can check it out yourself. Bill Maher, just look up Politically Incorrect and what's his name? Marilyn Manson. And then you'll see that. And Floris Henderson is on the same panel as well as G. Gordon Liddy. And I would like to see that whole show. I didn't see the whole show. I'd like to watch that whole show. I don't know about that show. I'd like that show to come back. But it's so frustrating. And, of course, she doesn't stop talking, too. You can't get a word in edgewise. And where you will find out most about her is on the CBN.com, the 700 Club. So she's right there with Pat Robertson and her abstinence only campaign. She represents everyone from the ghetto, you will hear her say. She grew up with a hard life and her parents. I'm trying to remember the story. I didn't write it down, unfortunately. You know, listen, everyone had there's millions of people with hard life stories. And it's that type of mindset that she talked about, her particular story, that is what the problem is. And I wish I could recall it exactly how it all went down. Oh, I know what it was. Okay, she was an army brat, and I think, and
wait, maybe.
Oh shoot! I printed on the back of this. Oh yeah, here we go. Lakita grew up in one of the most dangerous places to live, Los Angeles. Lakita's father was in the Air Force for 27 years and was a strong disciplinarian. After he died of cancer when Lakita was 11, her mother was left with the responsibility of raising Lakita and her four older brothers. Her mother was also strict. They used to call her Warden, says Lakita. Growing up, Lakita says one of the biggest rules in their household was to be in the house when the streetlights were on. Being outside when the streetlights came, if the streetlights came on, She had a curfew, okay? Being outside when the streetlights came on meant that you could get involved in gang drug activity and a lot of other unpleasant activities. Says Lakita. So when my mother said to be somewhere at a certain time, there were reasons why, though the children didn't understand the reasons at the time, Lakita says they were expected to obey. Lakita says her mother was not afraid to parent her children. The lack of parenting I witness on a daily basis blows me away, says Lakita. Her mother was not only God-fearing, but Lakita says she was committed to raising her kids right. She taught them about a lifestyle of abstinence. Abstinence is saving sex until marriage, says Lakita. It means I do, meaning I do you, do me, and we don't do nobody else, says Lakita. Well, I wasn't raised with a curfew, but I didn't live in Los Angeles. So, I mean, keeping people inside when the lights go off, that might be a safe thing to do because you don't want your kids to get killed by, people that can do a lot more things under cover of the night than they could do in broad daylight when everybody else is around. There was a curfew in Colt Mount. So in the summers, I had a curfew at 6 o'clock when you were under a certain age. And you would know that it was that time because the firehouse would blow their engine. Blow their horn. I'm looking at the time. I got to get on a We Talk Games interview. So that would happen. I did have a curfew when I was in Colt Mount. It didn't make me a better person. I didn't get in trouble when I didn't have to obey the curfew. At my house, when I was over 12 years old, I think I could stay out till like 1 o'clock in the morning. I had a curfew too. I didn't get anyone pregnant, and I had sex. I don't remember exactly how old I was when I had sex. But this is just so silly to say, curfew and overparenting and being strict is the only way to be. My morals are probably higher than Lakita's because Lakita's are only based on what she reads in the Bible. She obviously doesn't read the, things like, I don't think she's stoned any fags. I certainly haven't because that would be wrong. Okay. It'd be wrong to kill anybody. And I don't need a book to tell me that. Although the book tells me that I should be doing that. I should stone if a man lies with another man, it's abomination. So I should probably stone him. I should stone people that tell lies. I should stone a kid that talks back to his parents. Even if their parents are on meth, you don't talk to your meth parents. Okay. And try to get them cleaned up. You don't talk back. You get stoned to death. I doubt that Lakita follows those commandments because she talks about the Ten Commandments in this interview. There's just so much wrong with these types of tunnel visions. Because, they're far more than Ten Commandments, and we've explored how this number 10 is just, blown into here at a later time. I have a lot more to talk about. I definitely have a lot to talk about on things. We could talk about the cross. We could talk about the Old Testament. I definitely have some things to talk about Jesus and the people that he is raised from the dead. I would like to revisit that. I have to jump on We Talk Games, and I'll be right back. To you, no time will pass. All right, 10-minute interview, and yet somehow nearly an hour has passed since I left you. But to you, no time has passed. Except the time I waste in telling you that. Now, I did watch Constantine's Sword from one of my Netflix picks. And this movie is a documentary based on the nonfiction book and narrated by the author of it as well. And really, it talks about the anti-Jewish happenings ever since the days of Constantine, which Constantine was 4th century, like around 300 AD, 312, around there. And it talks about his sword. Now, it doesn't talk about his sword. Well, it does, but it really is focuses around anti-Semitism and how the Vatican has been associated with anti-Semitism since the days of Constantine, of course, not all the way back to it, but around those times when Catholicism came into popularity and Christianity really came to rise. I mean, it really doesn't talk about very much about the early days of Constantine. That's sort of like the trickle-down effect, but it eventually leads to how the Vatican was even behind like the Nazi regime and everything else, and how the symbol of the cross has really been, I mean, what I get out of here is like sort of like the symbol of the cross can equate to people wearing the swastika, you know what I mean? It really can equate to that type of a symbol of war. And it's based on the fact that the reason that Constantine embraced the cross symbol was of his vision that he had. The first vision that he had, and he identified this with Christ. And in a dream, he saw the words, "In this sign conquer," and this assured him victory in battle. And he put that sign on top of his shields and things like this, and later he had like a wand with the cross on and stuff like that. But we also have to realize that Constantine embraced the Chiro, and I'm not sure I'm saying that right. The Chiro is that elongated letter P with the X in the middle of it. You've seen this. This is the representation of the word Christ from the Greek, which is sort of like X, P, I, that O that's sort of connected to a mushroom-looking T, and then an O with a dot above it, and then a Q that you never finished. That was, of course, Christ in Greek, and I don't know how to say that, but that monogram thing was the Chiro symbol, and Constantine used this a lot. It was on a lot of his placards on backs of money and things like this, and this is when Constantine really embraced Christianity as a religion. His mother was a big proponent of trying to find artifacts from historical artifacts, purportedly, of Christianity. I mean, she's the one that went and found the original cross that Christ was crucified upon. Now, really, I mean, of course, it wasn't the real cross. This was 300 years later, after the supposed crucifixion of Christ. And really, was the Phoenician cross in use at that time with the crossbar, or was he really crucified on a tree, more like a single stake, which was more popular in the time of crucifixion during that time of Christ? I'm not going to go into there. I'm not going to get in there. But these are all questions that I have, of course. But this movie sort of is very good. Number one, I mean, it's this person's point of view on it. It definitely looks into the Air Force Academy and things like going on like that, where we see a very strong Christian influence, even on non-Christians and things like this. So it's kind of neat. But it does sort of, I mean, I was left with the impression that Constantine really pushed the symbol of the cross, and we got the cross from Constantine, but we see the cross being used for Christianity, and I mentioned the Tau earlier, which is, of course, very non-Christian in use before that, and there's a lot of other versions of the cross in use before Christianity, like the Ankh, which is the loop cross of the Egyptians. Many people wear a cross. I even wrote it in my song, Boom Tube. Used to wear a cross. I thought it was an Ankh, that type of thing, that type of sentiment. But we, like I said, Phoenicians, I believe, are credited with the cross and some of the earliest versions of that. And but it was definitely in place by some of the earlier church fathers before Constantine. So, you know, Constantine was not the first person to use the cross with Christianity. I sort of got that from this Constantine's sword video. But definitely, I mean, let's face it, Constantine put Christianity into popularity, raised it to a place that it probably would not have made it without Constantine's conquering ability and him making it the official religion of the Roman Empire. I mean, so much came out of Rome, of even, you know, of modern philosophy and philosophies, and just so much of the modern age, it came out of Rome, that it's hard to not be influenced by the fact that Constantine made it the official religion. Now, at the time, Constantine also was still celebrating some of his pagan religions, and he wanted some of them still kept and prominent. Even though, I mean, this is the guy, this is, like I said, 4th century, this is the guy that you know, formed the Council of Nicaea. He wanted to, these are when the books really came together. So, when we talk about biblical things, when we talk about Lakita Garth's Bible is not evil, there really was no Bible in the first 200 years of Christianity, 300 years of Christianity, not until the Council of Nicaea was convened to put together concise books of what was going to be a part of the Bible from these various other existing pieces of work, like things that would be found like in an individual church doctrine, letters, especially the letters of Paul. Now, we know that Paul probably didn't start writing until 70. Maybe Mark was probably around 90, if not later. Some may say 130s, you know, that this all started. But definitely there were no eyewitnesses, or there were nobody, well, I shouldn't say there were no eyewitnesses. I mean, I say that because that's what I believe. But if I read what is written, then there are eyewitnesses. It's just that nobody wrote anything while this stuff was going on. Now, you might think that, you know, that's okay, and historically that's how things happen. But a lot of things were being written in what, you know, Christians might say is the year zero. But doesn't the years, isn't the, when was Christ crucified, in 30 or in zero? I don't know how after death would indicate that then you would have 30 years of B.C. before Christ. That would mean that everything B.C. would be before the number zero, and then A.D. would mean after 30. So there's 30 years where we don't keep years. you know, no, that's not accurate. I don't know what I'm talking about, but that's sort of what those two letters mean to me, is it would mean to me that we'd be missing 3 years, 30 years. But so, I mean, when do we start time? Do we start time after death of Christ and then before he died? I think that's what it, I think it means that, I don't know what it, let me look at what people consider this. Well, what I get from Wiki Answers is BC stands for before Christ and AD for Anno Domini, which is Latin for the in the year of our Lord. So scholars prefer the BCE and CE, which stands before Common Era and Common Era, respectively, to mean the same as BC and AD, but not to imply Christian connotations, although it uses BCE before Common Era. So, so yeah, this really doesn't tell me anything, but I have to believe that it means that, and there is no year zero, of course, I was being facetious there. That BC is supposed to be when before Christ was born, and then AD is supposed to be after Christ was born, although I was always told it meant after death, but it means in the year of the Lord instead. I guess that was a way for us to remember, us good Christian lads. And I don't even know what I was saying. So I guess that, you know, he died in 30 AD. And then, of course, everyone forgot about him. No one remembered the guy that resurrected 500 people when he died. No one remembers the earthquake and the blackening of the city when he was crucified and him going up. Remember? We have a problem there. Up on a where he's on a sphere. He goes up. That's a problem. He should have said he went out. So I would say out from Earth. Where he went out to, that's another problem, isn't it? Yes. But so you know, no one really started writing about this stuff until quite a while after he'd already supposedly been dead and flying around on a cloud up to heaven. So what about, why didn't anyone ever write about, and I've asked this before, but I ask it again now, why didn't anyone bother to write about Christ when he was walking around, when he was doing something? Especially absent would be like me, like this show. I've already talked about how much I don't like Pat Robertson. I've talked about how much I don't like Lakeeta Dingleberry, Lakeeta Garth Brooks. I talked about Ben Stein. I imitated him. you may get the idea that these people were real people because of their detractors. Why wouldn't anyone of course, not everyone loved Christ, but yet the only writings we find about him are in by his people caught up in the Christology, people caught up in the books about Jesus. We don't really hear the anti-Jesus people. Where are the people that say, oh yeah, Jesus came into town today on a donkey. What a jerk. People surely would have written this. People would have written, you know, this guy got crucified today. He said he was the king of the Jews. He said, or, you know, whatever Jesus is being described in the Bible, there should be those detractors to that Jesus being described in the Bible. Oh, the great teacher came today. I listened to him. I didn't think he knew that much. I didn't think he was that great a teacher. I thought he was kind of pompous. And, or, you know, here comes this guy. He says he's a king of God. Well, I know a lot of king of gods. I know king of Kongs. I know a lot of king. I know a lot of sons of God, and he's not one of them. No detractors. We've found no documentations from his detractors saying, I hate this guy. I hate this Jesus. So, you know, that's, of course, troublesome. That's another problem of Christianity. But besides the fact that no writings are left around outside of Christology, outside of the support of Christology. And, of course, all apologists will point to Josephus and the other. And once again, these are just people that talked about Christians and the existence of Christians in the early age. And there's no doubt that there were Christians. But what Christians are people describing? Are they describing people that worshipped a real, actual person? I've talked about it on the last episode, an episode before, I believe, I think. Although the last episode really sucked, and I apologize for that. I'm not too sold on this episode. I hope it's solid. I hope it's a good episode. I hope you're enjoying yourself. Because I'm having a pretty good time. I stumbled in the beginning there, but, you know, I'm a little sick, and things aren't 100% with me. So I hope that you forgive me. But here's the thing. Paul's writing do not talk about Jesus starting the church. Jesus starting his church. He walked around as a teacher. He was schooling people. Paul's Jesus was quite the Christ mythical figure, quite in tune with the various beliefs that were going around in the day, and quite dealing with more of a mythical entity. And, you know, as Constantine's mother went to Jerusalem to find the cross outside of Calvary or wherever she went to get this, Paul never did that. Paul never took a pilgrimage to go look at where Jesus was born, the manger. Never went to visit. He went to Jerusalem, but he never went to visit, you know, people where places where Jesus went and retrace the footsteps and go on the hill outside of Jerusalem to visit the place where his Lord was slain by his own people, by you know, his fellow man, which is, you know, kind of odd, because he really liked this Jesus, the Christ guy. You know, he really liked this Christ guy. Paul did. He was responsible for sparking the whole Christ type of religion, really bringing it to the front with his letters, with his writings. So, and once again, you know, he didn't start writing, but he never met the Jesus person. He, you know, saw a vision and said, "Yes, I will worship you, Jesus Christ." So there's, you know, a mythical Christ. There's definitely, I mean, purely, I mean, there's, I don't know how anyone can say there's not proof of a mythical Jesus concept, idea. And as you learn more about the early writings about Christ, early writings about Jesus, as you start trying to put these times together, these different people together, these different authors' ideas of this Jesus person, of this Jesus Christ, of this Jesus teacher, of this Jesus healer, exorcist, church founder, you know, wise man, son of God, Savior, Davidian ruler, you know, all these different Jesuses, and each author's portrayal and each author's story of what they want to make Jesus out to be, of what type of Christian story they want to bring. As you do all these things, as you see all these different types of Christs, and put it all together, you can't help but see that there is some type of mythology here being married with some people with very different ideas. And then somehow over 300 years, we get the Christ that we read about in our New Testament now. But that notwithstanding, the fact that nobody wrote this down when it was going on, that really doesn't matter. Why doesn't that matter? Why doesn't it matter that anybody wrote something down? Because we should still have something that exists from the time period to prove that Jesus was really a person and really did perform miracles. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. Jesus also raised Jairus' daughter from the dead. That's in Matthew 9:18-26, Mark 5:41-42, Luke 8:52-56, and a widow's son in Luke 7:11-15. Jesus raised people from the dead, raised Lazarus from the dead, raised Jairus' daughter, and the widow's son. You raise those people from the dead. So where's Lazarus now? Where's Lazarus? And by the way, I think it'd be a perfect new superhero, Lazarus. He's actually, you know, the guy that was raised from the dead by Jesus. Of course, he can't be killed, because what good would raising someone from the dead be if you just died again? It'd kind of be dumb. Really, how am I saved from death? I'm just going to die later. That's doesn't make any sense. So, you know, the fact that Lazarus isn't around, that Jairus' daughter isn't around, that the widow's son isn't still around. And, you know, these aren't the only people raised from the dead. Elijah raised a boy from the dead in 1 Kings 17:22. Elijah raised a boy from the dead in 2 Kings 4:34 through 35. Then Elijah's bones, his bones raised a man from the dead in 2 Kings 13:20, 21. Once again, we could just get those bones and raise some people from the dead, just bring them back. In Acts 9, 40 through 41, Peter raises a woman from the dead. And in Acts 20, 9 through 20, Paul raised a man from the dead. And once again, showing that this type of power of Christ, this Christ power, could be passed on to his disciples, to the people that believe in him, and they could perform these miracles that Christ was purported to have done. But getting back again, Lazarus, I mean, where is he? He should still be alive, my friends, as should all these other people raised from the dead. Unless you're just supposed to die again, which, once again, not very good stuff. People have always argued, you know, Jesus came back. Jesus didn't come back. Jesus performed miracles. You know, he walked on water. He turned water into wine. Made a lot of fishes. From couple dozen loaves of bread or something. Raised people from the dead. Healed leprosy. Made a pig come out of a guy. You know, all these other types of things. What good has he done? Nothing. He's very relative, very localized. Of course, these miracle stories were attributed to lots of people, but they were attributed to people that we could also verify and back up by people that weren't worshipers of these figures, and I've talked about that before. But I mean, he didn't do anything that was for the good of mankind, except dying for our sins. Well, people still sin, and sin still happens, and people suffer needlessly. The guilty are not punished. They're not innocent people suffer, like we see with these floods, and you know, childhood AIDS, and death in childbirth still is a big problem. You know, it really didn't do anything for us. It didn't do anything good. He cured leprosy. He just healed one person of leprosy, or two people. You know, leprosy was still around until he outgrew it, or, you know, whatever happened. I guess it still happens sometimes. But I think the fact that we don't have writings, but we don't have Lazarus. We don't have these people, these miracles that he performed. They didn't hang around. They didn't make it. They didn't make it. They should still be alive. There's no reason why the Son of God couldn't raise you from the dead and you stay alive. Now, no one mentions that, but no one also says that they died again later. Maybe they do. Maybe they do say Lazarus died later. I don't recall right now. I'm a little little under it, but I feel okay. I feel good. You know, and you may say, well, you know, how can these myths, you know, change over time? How can this really come together? How can this at all be mythology and then people believe it and things like this? Well, like I said, Constantine was still building temples, like to the sun. Constantine was still doing more pagan rituals, worshiping Greek gods, Apollo, and things like this. There was nothing wrong with that. It was nothing out of place. How can it get twisted? Well, it gets twisted because we take it for granted what our parents tell us. I mean, how many Christians today don't go against their beliefs because it would make them uncomfortable in front of their parents and peers and friends? I'm sure there's a lot. And I'm sure anyone that has made it through that and went on to finally admit that they were non-theist or atheist or whatever, went through a period where they were uneasy about it, you know, and didn't want to cause trouble and didn't want to stir the pot. I'll just read right from Constantine the First, Wikipedia. Why not? You know, Wikipedia is all true. The reign of Constantine established a precedent for the position of the emperor in the Christian church. Constantine himself disliked the risks of societal stability. He didn't like when there was unrest in society. The religious disputes and controversies brought with them, preferring where possible to establish an orthodoxy. The emperor saw it as his duty to ensure that God was properly worshipped in his empire. And what proper worship consisted of was for the church to determine. In 316, Constantine acted as a judge in a North African dispute concerning the validity of Donatism. After deciding against the Donatists, Constantine led an army of Christians against the Donatist Christians. After 300 years of pacifism, this was the first intra-Christian persecution. More significantly, in 325, he summoned the Council of Nicaea, effectively the first ecumenical council, unless the Council of Jerusalem is so classified. Nicaea was to deal mostly with the heresy of Arianism, which was becoming popular. And see, it's called a heresy. Any discourse, any divergence from what is the established belief at the time is considered a heresy. It's just a different idea. Constantine also enforced the prohibition of the First Council of Nicaea against celebrating Lord's Supper on the day before Jewish Passover, Nisan 14, C, quarter, so blah, blah, blah. And then also Constantine made new laws regarding the Jews. They were forbidden to own Christian slaves or to circumcise their slaves. But Constantine did not patronize Christianity alone. However, after gaining victory in the Battle of Milvian Bridge, a triumphal arch, the Arch of Constantine was built to celebrate. The arch is decorated with images of Victoria and sacrifices to God like Apollo, Diana, or Hercules, but contains no Christian symbolism. In 321, Constantine instructed the Christians and non-Christians should be united in observing the venerable day of the sun. Even after the pagan gods had disappeared from the coinage, Christian symbols... in Day of the Sun, referencing the esoteric Eastern sun worship, which Arlian had helped introduce. That was a previous king, I believe. And had helped introduce, and his coinage still carried the symbols of the sun cult until 324. Even after the pagan gods had disappeared from the coinage, Christian symbols appear only as Constantine's personal attributes, the chiro, which I explained before, between his hands or on his labrum, but never on the coin itself. Ah, I see. Even when Constantine dedicated the new capital of Constantinople, which became the seat of the Byzantine Christianity for a millennium, he did so wearing the Apollyon sun-rayed diadem. So, you know, here's a guy, of course, that believed in Christianity, spread Christianity, but it was really no different than Hercules, Apollo, and everything else. It was still very, very... just a continuation, a follow-through. I mean, who knows? Maybe he did believe, oh, you know, Apollo's not real, even though he's doing both simultaneously. That's not real. This is real, whatever. His mom's all into it. What, you know. Who knows? I mean, that's a long time ago. But it just shows that, you know, 300, the 4th century, this is when this stuff really started picking up. You know, this is when it started picking up speed. And, of course, once again, it's still only, we're only talking about Greece and Rome. We're talking about Italy here. We're talking about maybe some places in, you know, in the Mediterranean. We're talking about other cults that are coming in from more from the deserts. We're talking about perhaps, you know, Northern Africa, probably around those regions at the most. We still don't see, you know, Christ was not known in China. Christ was not known in Japan. Christ was not known by those sects. Even maybe even in India, not really known. You know, as the further east you go, you probably didn't have that. And shouldn't everyone know that, hey, Son of God is on earth, everyone? Might not want to make it so local. You know, might want to get off the football there. Do something. Now, I know if we talk to Lakita Garth, if we talk to Pat Robertson, we ask them, you know, when did Christ die? It would be like he died for our sins like yesterday, you know. It really doesn't matter. This Christology, this mythology, this happening really changes with the times. The commandments that we follow. You know, you can find all types of apologetics to make it be that all the commandments are gone, but we don't do the commandments that are relating to slavery any longer, as far as I know. You know, we sort of are governed by our own morals, and then we find things in the our articles of faith that try to that mirror these self-imposed consensus of the day, because definitely, you know, Lakita wouldn't be speaking if we're talking, depending on which part of the Bible we read, where it says, you know, women shut your mouths and you can only show that you are, your faith in Jesus through bearing children. She definitely would be out. You know, she would have to get the stone because, you know, if I wanted to make a case for that, I could put that on a T-shirt and a banner and wave it in front of her face, and then you know, she'd have to do that, I guess. I don't know, because that's what she believes. But we can see this mythology and how it changes and how it is converted for our timeline, even by looking at our own heroes of the day. I mean, what year is Superman from? If you watch Smallville, you'd think he's from, you know, a couple years ago when the season started, and he's maturing and he's growing in age. I mean, this is not like the Schuster Superman. This is not Jerry Siegel, you know, in control of this. We've seen the Man of Krypton change and, you know, be modified for the time by his artists, by his authors. Look at John Byrne's recreation of Superman. We had the death of Superman, for cripe's sake. You know, it's amazing. How about, you know, the Man of Steel, the Man of Tomorrow? All the nicknames for Superman. Let's look at Max Fleischer's Superman. It's amazing. It's amazing stuff. We can see how, and I know that I'm talking about a decidedly mythical creation here, but there's other people that are not so mythical in modern day that were worshipped as, you know, sons of God. I mean, let's look at Rabbi Shlomo. He died in 1994, and his legacy is still living on. There's bands following his cult and making converts with their music. What about even things like Scientology with, you know, L. Ron Hubbard? How is detoxification not a part of your daily shopping chores in the United States? You can go into a shopping center and you go to the vitamin aisle and you're bound to find some detoxification drugs in there. Now, are they the same type of detoxification? No, but maybe not, perhaps not, but it all relates around Hubbard's toxin ideas, purging the body of toxin. I mean, the United States government put money into FAZE from $12 million in grants into FAZE, F-A-S-E. Find out about that. Read out about that. I mean, this is to, you know, help detoxify some of the firefighters involved in the 9/11 tragedies and stuff like that. So we can see religions, cults, and things like that influencing even people from today. You know, influential. Now, how influential is Shlomo to the everyday person? Not very much. I guess if you live around some places in New York, then you might have heard of him, might have known about it through this through the rock band that carries on his belief. But they definitely believe that. True believers in Shlomo definitely still believe that he's alive. And, I mean, thank goodness that the Mormons have baptized such great dead people as Hitler and Genghis Khan. And, Mormonism is a great example of, I mean, everyone's heard of Mormons, right? They're in the news for good or bad reasons. Of course, everyone's heard of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, that's for sure. And, you know, here is a very, very recent Christ cult. And it's not, I mean, it's based on new books. That is why they're called, Mormons, the Church of Latter-day Saints. Their saints are still happening. And, you know, once again, the Catholics, of course, know Constantine as Saint Constantine. We sanctify, the Catholics sanctify people that murder people openly, in the sign of the cross. They conquer in the sign of the cross. It doesn't matter. You're still a saint. All the great things they do for healing and helping through murder. But, and I'm sure there's a ton more cults that we could talk about here that are still happening today, modifying, transmogrifying, becoming hip with the kids, getting hip with the sounds of jazz and reggae. And Catholicism definitely changes throughout the years. I was involved with Catholicism as a youth. I was also involved in the Worldwide Church of God, and certainly that too underwent a lot of changes after Armstrong's death. All right, I'm rambling. Hi, I noticed on a previous A Wiggly World you said you hold no degree in anything, and yet I hold about 101 degree. Temperature in anything, and yet you seem so knowledgeable in computers, computer networking, etc. In fact, you state that you even have a technician job. Yes, I'm the IT administrator for a local advertising firm. That's awesome. My question is, how did you become so knowledgeable in this field, Ross? Right. 1992-93. I needed to create an album cover for Flying Discs of Love, Trapdoor, Flying Discs of Love, a Major Donald Kehoe commemorative EP. So I wanted to make something that wasn't a hand drawing. And all the production studios at that time were only using an application called Quark Express. Remember, Quark is the company. Express is the name of their crappy product. And it's not really crappy. It is a great printing application. Fantastic printing application. In fact, anyone that really loves Express is, pretty much an ardent fan of it, in that, you know, they think nothing else is better. And, you know, they're indignant to having to use InDesign now. But the truth is, unfortunately, that the reason that I call a crappy app is because crap app, yeah, crap, is because Quirk tech support and their attitude towards their customer stinks on ice. And you will know this if you've had to deal with the tech support. Now, I've had pretty good luck. I've only had one or two condescending people when we had trouble with our Quirk key license server. But Quirk Express at the time was only available on a Mac, and that's what almost every printing house used. A PC in a print house at the time was unheard of. Later, that would not be the case. And in fact, even in newspapers and stuff like that, you saw more and more PCs popping up. But at the time, most of that was because people wanted pricing, you know, the pricing. That's really negligible now. And it even was negligible back then for what you got for your money. So at the time, it was only available on a Mac. So I got a Mac, bought it off a friend of mine who was a big Mac head. He was a big geek head. In fact, he was good at anything. He knew PCs. He knew DOS. He knew it all. He built things. His dad built things. He built computer controlled light boards and everything else back at early 90s. So, you know, he really knew a lot. And even though he knew a lot, he still loved Macs. He was a Mac enthusiast. And I asked him about that one time. And he said, well, the reason he likes Macs is because he is so knowledgeable. You know, why do things in addition to the things that you are really trying to accomplish when the Mac can handle most of that back end for you? You don't have to worry about, you know, all the things that you would have to worry about if you're trying to do it through DOS and things like this. So I might as well use a product that's an actual really real tool for trying to get the job done that I'm trying to do. So that's why I like Macs. And I bought my first Mac 2 SE off of him. And I won't bore you with trying to talk about what type of things it was made of and everything else, but let me tell you, it costs a whole lot of money, and it, of course, wasn't very powerful at all. And this is before PowerPC's, PowerPC, you know, CPU was being implemented. So it still had like a floating point unit that was different than how the PowerPCs did. And so he had, I bought that, and I had Photoshop. I think it was Photoshop 2.5 or Photoshop 3, somewhere around there. I had that, and I had Quirk Express, and I had a 3D program called Infinity. And from that, and from trying to get this album cover together, I had to teach myself a lot of stuff. And, you know, I went over my buddies like once just to try to understand file structures and how that all worked. And I took notes on all this and if I wanted to do shortcuts and keyboard equivalents and things like this. And then I saw how the keyboard equivalents were and, you know, just the basics, learning about a lot of different things. And that was really cool. And of course, you know, we're talking about an early OS. I'm not sure if I had OS. Yeah, I think it was still an OS 7, 7.5 or something around there. I don't really, 7.1 maybe. I'm not sure. And then I remember going up to OS 8, and I remember getting my first, getting a machine above there, Mac. I don't remember. But it had a CD player in it. It was one of the first with a CD player in it. That was a lot of loot. And then I remember going to the G3, which was then that's when I moved to the PowerPC architecture. And I had a G3. And, you know, I followed the Macs all the way up. G3, G4, G5, and now the Mac Pro. And because I knew so much in Macs and really learned it inside out and knew everything I possibly could about it, from then just being self-taught, I was able to secure a job at Gravis Kensington. Actually, before that, Daytimers, which was the same organization. And Daytimers was here in Allentown. They were opening a new tech support for... Oh, no, it was for... Oh, boy. Oh, it was for Kensington. Kensington Mice. That's right. So Daytimers already had applications that they were supporting, but I was going to get a job at Kensington to support all Kensington input devices, like mice, keyboards, the Orbit. And actually, Kensington made several hundred products, believe it or not. So, like, they made wipes and monitor wipes and things that we needed to know, OSHA stuff on and everything. So it was really something. Because we had to support, you know, several hundred products. No matter what people called in about, we had to support it. And our mice had input software that, because most of the Kensington mice were multi-button mouses, and so they had these macros that can be embedded and stuff like this, and they're quite sophisticated mice. They could do a lot of things that other mice couldn't, that were being offered by other companies and things like that, and they really had a lot of brilliant people working on their mouse software. So I was hired on there to this new division that was moving from California to the Allentown area. And I was hired on because of my extensive Mac knowledge. And once I got my 1 month training or 2 month training or whatever it was, I don't recall, I was trained on the PC. Windows 95 was the popular operating system. Windows 98 was just going to be coming out or somewhere around there. And I got a job in tech as a tech support for Kensington. And so from learning the mice software and learning how to fix Windows NT trouble, which was, I mean, I think, I'm not sure if Windows NT 4 was out or did we support before NT 4? I'm not sure. Well, we had to do a lot of low-level things dealing with these mice drivers and the mouse software and stuff like that. So a lot of times we were called to, you know, drop out the DOS, boot up in safe mode, do a lot of these other things that you would take for granted now ever since Windows 98, definitely Windows XP. A lot of these things would be taken for granted. But I was there during that switchover time. And I also decided to challenge myself and learn Windows 3.11, you know, Windows 3.11, learn the NT side of it. And I set up labs, and we set up labs, and there was all different types of really neat stuff going on at the time. This was a time when Macs, even some of them still came with DOS boards, so you can actually boot in a DOS on your Mac. It had an actual chip on there that had DOS on it. I guess, like, as part of the RAM, and or somehow, I don't really know. As part of, I think it was embedded on that chip though. And you could only do root. I mean, you couldn't install Windows on it or anything. But it was an actual DOS. You can drop out the DOS. You could reboot in the DOS, and it was dual boot system. So it was a really neat time to get into technology. And because I challenged myself, I became the go-to guy. Well, when I was a Mac guru, I was the go-to guy for Mac's questions. And then I became the go-to guy for Windows 3.11 and Windows NT questions. Because for some reason, it clicked with me. I got it. I understood. And I really had a good basis for a technical approach to this technology. And a technician's approach to it, I should say. And I knew what questions to ask, and maybe that plays right into, you know, wanting to know so much about technology, wanting to know so much about what I believe and everything, how I question existence. It all plays into that. And I think the reason I'm still a good technician is because I have a good approach. I have a very good approach to breaking an issue in half. And finding a solution, knowing what questions to ask, determining the most I can about what was going on when the issue occurred. And, you know, these different steps that I learned and how to look at things. So from there, I actually got a job as, after working there for a year or so or more, 2 years, I don't recall. I know I moved on to Gravis, which was... If you know anything about Gravis, they made joysticks and game pads and game controller pads and things like this. So I got more into gaming then, which was awesome because you have a job where you could, you know, test different joysticks and play games all day. And I had a Mac and a PC on my desk. That was awesome. So I could do all these different types of things. And we were doing Napster when that came out. It was a good old time. That was a good time. That's some good stuff going on at that time. You know, things that predated Torrent, like Hotline Client and stuff like that. That was neat. That was some neat times. So then I became a tech for Gravis. And at Gravis, you had to get a lot more technical than you did for Kensington for some reason. Because you were dealing with input sprockets, and then on the Mac side, and then on the PC side, you were dealing with, you know, their DirectX, or their DirectX and all this other type of business. So you had to really learn your way around installing applications, installing games. Sometimes we sent out viruses on our software and stuff like that that had to be, you know, we had to do damage control on that and then help people reinstall Windows and everything else. Yikes, reinstall in place and stuff like that. And then after working there for a while, I became an independent consultant for a local tech firm. And it was there that I really had to know my P's and Q's and know a little bit about everything. And I work just sort of like a data entry type of person, but I worked around a mainframe, and that was really neat. And then a person that helped get me into tech, you know, I don't really know which came first on how I met him, but I didn't meet him and worked with him at Gravis and at Kensington, and then I was a consultant at the same firm that he was, and then we became part of this Y2K project to go out and make the whole place, all of this Lucan's steel plate safe for Y2K. This is part of the Bethlehem Steel and stuff, a lot of history with that. So I did that. I got the joint ready for Lucan's, and I got the joint ready for Y2K, and they had Windows 3.11, they had Windows NT, they had Windows 95, they had Windows 98, they had Macs, they had an Amiga, they had every type of system you could think of. They had DEC units and stuff like this. So that was really cool, and I was helping them. Somehow I helped with getting Windows 3.11 networked. With like internet and stuff like that, and that was really cool. So that was neat, because then you had to use TCP stacks and everything like this. It was cool stuff. And then I became the lead of that project then, after my partner had left that project. And as soon as I was, you know, this free agent, I got hired on to work for OmniPoint. OmniPoint then got bought out by VoiceStream, and VoiceStream got bought out by T-Mobile. And lo and behold, I became an IT administrator for T-Mobile. And I was part of this advanced desktop group where we actually, you know, did incredibly the most that you can do, I think, with Active Directory. So it was all a long process, but all the way along, I made it through. Just because of my ability to know what questions to ask and know where to look to find the answers if I didn't already know them. So that is a very, very long answer to my tech field. And now I'm independent, and I'm, you know, I do everything from soup to nuts for this company I work for now, this advertising agency. And not only do I do everything from soup to nuts, I mean, I designed some of the virtual networking that we went to. I configured the servers that we were going to get, backup solutions. I mean, you name it. I advise on what technology we should go to for developing websites for their client, for their, you know, multi-thousand, you know, big six-figure clients and everything else, seven-figure and what have you. So there's a lot of websites, a lot of. I have to know just about, you know, anything that you could think of to need to know. That's what I do. And, you know, I started creating accounts for Exchange a long time ago, but I never had to build my own Exchange server. I worked with backup servers. I implemented them. I, you know, put them together, did things like that. But I never had to do it as much as I do it now. And, you know, I only had done it maybe once or twice in the past. I knew about it. So this really challenges me. This is really good, but it's also very time consuming. And you can imagine walking into a place that had, you know, twice as many servers as a 1,000-room, 1,000-seat call center. It just blew my mind immediately. And I found out later that there's even more and more and more. Just to draw up the diagram for my infrastructure is at least 4 pages of just solid text, just explaining what each server does, what's on it, and everything else. So trying to consolidate that down is a great learning experience and great fun. So thank you for that. I'm going to save this because I'm still waiting for a reply as whether I could talk about that or not. New blog, old time. So I started the blog, and you started with "so" in both capitals. That, what are you doing, Paul? You know that... maybe you don't know. So I started a blog. I told you I was going to start like in June. I have the money for equipment, but I've been very busy in new band and school. But now I have the time. I have some other friends who are interested, and they said they are all down to produce content. We're going to spend a month starting today building up material for the show. So give us a shout out. We are currently unofficial, but would like to become an officially the teen version of your show. Peace out, California Connection, Paul Verdugo. And you can see him on Facebook. This is the, what was originally called Teens Wiggly or Teens for Wiggly or Wiggly Teen, American Teen Werewolf. All right, I see how lovely this is. The Teens Wiggly Super Blah. I think this is just abandoned. The two comments on Teens Wiggly Super Blog are join by Paul, and then Vishant says, "Why is this group so gay?" That's lovely. Really lovely. Chrissy is the VIP, and I am a VIP of this as well, and it has 14 members. I'm a hit, kids. Yeah. No, I thought I went to a place and I thought I went somewhere and I saw something. Maybe I didn't. Who knows? Yay. First blog in forever with that a face written in zeros and underscore O. Cheerios. Yeah. So I don't know what's going on with this, but check them out. Teens Wiggly on Facebook. And you, too, can be one of the 31 members of Teens Wiggly. The large majority of them, not teens. I am 18.org. In our last letter, I hope I can read this. I'm going to read it. I'll have to bleep it if I'm not allowed to read it. And geez, what am I at here? Three and some change, probably. Almost. Gotta admit, it says, "Enjoyed your last Wiggly World, January's." Wow, well. Okay. Gotta admit, I haven't been keeping up as much as I'd like. Work gets in the way, but I'm going back and trying to catch up. Well, thanks, man. Just really started thinking about the lyrics to your Agogo theme music. I was searching for the answers until I changed the questions. Yeah, I do that sometimes. I try to write lyrics that are maybe mean something. I don't know. A little relevant. I don't know. One thing, just to sidetrack myself as I grab a lozenge. You know, I hope that people realize that I certainly, and speaking of the last episode, which to me was a complete horrible mess, and even today, I'm not clear. You know, I'm not 100% clear in my mind. I'm trying to get back there, and I hope I can produce something of of a really good quality. There's some episodes I listen to. I revisit it. You know, I'm trying to see, hey, did I always stink? And some of the episodes on ghosts and where I go through an episode of Ghost Hunters or Ghost History, and I just go through it and examine each bit. I think, you know, that's a pretty good episode. I think I'm really doing something good here. But I never do this show because I think I'm so smart. Look at everything I know. And I know that's kind of evident because of how bad some of the shows are. But and I hope, I honestly hope that it comes through on all my products, on all my projects, and all my everything I'm involved with. That I certainly don't do them because I want to, you know, say, oh, yeah, look at me. I know everything about everything. Aren't I so clever? I do, you know, we talk games because I really love games. I have a passion for that. I do Chikara because I love Chikara. I believe in Chikara. And I don't write a song because I want to say, look at me, I'm playing a guitar. You know, I try to capture whatever I'm looking at and reinterpret it. And you know, that's what's called poetry. What we refer to as poetry, and that's, you know, what art is, a reflection of things. And I just hope it really comes through with, and I do this show because, not because I love to talk or anything like that, but because I'm passionate about the things I talk about. I love exploring things. I love asking questions, and I love challenging myself. And I hope that all just comes through, that, you know, I don't do any of these things to try to put myself out there in front of the masses and say, hey, look at me, look at me. Is that in there at all? I don't know. But it's definitely, I mean, it's not definitely not something conscious. Would I want to be on a big stage? Of course. But being on a big stage is never the motivation for what I do. What I do is because I can't. I can't imagine not doing these things because I have a passion for it. I have a love for it. So I just wanted to bring that up while I was thinking about this. And I mean, that's there's that's yeah. Just so songwriting. So thank you for listening to that. I really enjoyed your religious tangents. Gets people thinking and questioning. Honestly, if people doubt their faith, the best thing they can do is question it, their faith. Questioning, researching, will either strengthen it or lead you to the real truth. I like that. I really like that. Either way, it's a win-win. Yeah, you know, one of the earliest things I remember from the Worldwide Church of God and Herbert W. Armstrong. Well, first of all, I said, this is not the word of Herbert W. Armstrong. This is the word of God. And God said, God loves rebuke. He wants you to look for the answer. He wants you to search for the truth. This is not the word of Herbert W. Armstrong. So, I love that old fart. He was a cool dude on the television, you know, on the television at 1 a.m. I don't know what he's like in real life. Him and his big frickin', spy glass. What do you call that? Magnifying glass. There you go. I was actually raised as Jehovah's Witness since I was 4. Even got baptized when I was 17. But that was more for my mom than God. She was going through a rough patch after the divorce, and I somehow thought it would help her. Never brought it up on a show because I never officially severed ties, just drifted. Don't want to be exiled from friends and family after all. My main conclusion is that religion just gets in the way. Too much bureaucracy, principles being enforced like commandments, hypocrisy, etc. Jehovah's Witnesses have Christianity as close to the roots as I have experienced, and it's still flawed. And, you know, I really agree with that. I really, in some respects, until recently, I realized that how much Catholicism is actually like original Christianity, in the fact that, you know, people just keep making up crap as they go along. And that's also the way of, to some extent, the Church of Latter-day Saints. But yes, I definitely believe that the biggest organized religion outside of the Worldwide Church of God that I thought was searching for the truth in the Bible and outside of the Bible. I mean, before we heard from groups like the Discovery Institute, it was the Jehovah's Witnesses that had, science books that you could get that tried to gel Adam and Eve with science, the archaeological record and things like this. Yeah, he might have said that, Satan, planet, dinosaur bones, I don't know. It might have said that, you know, it didn't say that, but it sort of implied that, this word means that it was a perfect creation, and then this word means that something happened that it wasn't perfect, and so that means that, we surmise that perhaps, you know, Satan was in charge of it because he was top angel and things like this, and then he made dinosaurs and whatever. So I remember seeing that in some of the literature. But I definitely believe that, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses, I mean, they're the ones that are out there knocking on doors. They're the ones that are out there proselytizing like, hey, you know, this is real. We got to get on this. And they also look into stuff. But you know, like I've mentioned many, many times before, I definitely invited them to my house and doing Bible studies and went to their kingdom hall and everything else. So I'm not afraid of it. Never was afraid to challenge my faith. Never was afraid to challenge my beliefs. okay. The thing that really gets me is that back in the Mosaic Law, they had all these rules. Then Moses simplified it down to 10, and Jesus later to 2 rules: love God, love your neighbors as yourself. And they still can't live it. I really thought I had a point when I started writing all this down, but it's kind of rambling at this point. Now I realize how your shows often start with a concise objective and just meander, like Katamari, which is a perfect example. And this is like the Katamari of theology and other stuffs. Katamari, just picking up random thoughts until you have a 2.5-hour show or longer, or a long email in this case. So to wrap it up, thanks for letting me hang out in the chicken coop all those times and for igniting my own internal struggle and debate on God, faith, and religion. I really miss you guys. How's the new house? Well, the new house, as I mentioned, didn't happen. So we're still looking, and I'm still trying to find a lawyer to talk about buying this house here that is in the front of the property of which we live, and including the coop. So I'd probably tear down the coop and put a geodesic dome on here and then tear down the house later on. Yeah, like that'll ever happen. But seriously, folks, thank you. Listen, you are loved too, pal, because I got to tell you, well, if you don't know who that was from, that's from Stan. And I hope I didn't have to bleep this whole thing. Or just the parts that gave hints to it being Stan. But Stan, I loved having Stan on Milkshake. I loved having Stan on Smart Wrestling Fan. I really, really liked Stan a lot. I was all for the one-night Stan, which never happened. Then he moved out to the West Coast. And that was the end of that. But I always liked Stan on a show. I never wanted him to be gone from the show. And that's why I wanted him to be part of Milkshake when I started Milkshake. I really like what he has. He doesn't add a lot. But he's there. And that also made it great, you know. That also made it great. And the episode of Milkshake where it's just me, Stan, and Chiz, I think that's... That's a golden one there. It's one of my favorite episodes. Super du jour. Improv time as a first improv thing. Kit Kat. This is it for me, everybody. Kit Kat takes on Japanese taste from The Independent. Getting right into theology here. Nestle has given one of the most popular and long-established chocolate bars in the world a uniquely Japanese makeover. Kit Kat bars are now available in 19 new flavors that reflect specialties from regions across Japan, ranging from sweet potatoes from Okinawa to melons from Hokkaido, strawberries from Tochigi, green tea from Kyoto, and soy sauce from Tokyo. Launched late last year, Nestle said it hopes people will buy the lines, which are only available in Japan as souvenirs or as gifts. The company has also teamed up with Japan Post to produce boxes that can be sent through the mail. Oh, Japan Post, which is like their mail service, I guess, for Y140, which is equal to a fancy E 1.14 stamp. Is attached on one side of the box as a blank space for a message, in much the same way people send postcards from a holiday destination. Giving gifts is an important part of Japanese culture, and we like to travel, so we wanted to combine these two things together. Miki Kanoa, a spokeswoman for Kobe, that was exact impersonation of her. She sounded like Count Dracula. Spokeswoman for the Kobe-based company told Relax News. Other flavors include pungent wasabi, a green horseradish that is more commonly found in sushi, apple chili, miso, cherries, and strawberries cheesecake from Yokohama. And with the school and university exam season upon Japanese students, Kit Kats have also been finding their way into school lunchboxes as a good luck charm. Kit Kat, an expression invented in Britain in the 1930s, sounds close to Kito Katsu, a Japanese exam season mantra that literally means, I'll do my best to make sure I succeed. Tens of thousands of students will find the snacks in their lunchboxes over the coming weeks, mostly placed there by ambitious parents anxious for their success. Originally produced in September 1935 by Round Trees of England as the Chocolate Crisp Kit Kat is believed to get its name from the famous 1920s club of the same name in London. It's a best-selling chocolate biscuit in both Japan and the United States, and in the top 10 in the world. Well, I would love to get my hands on some of these crazy Kit Kat bars and bite me off a bit of that Kit Kat bar. Well, friends, here we are at the end of another riveting episode of Wiggly World. Good. I'm thinking about how I said riveting. I didn't talk about the episode with D'Lo Brown. I didn't talk about any pro wrestling, and I probably won't. I got it. There's a lot going on in pro wrestling, but I'm not really going to talk about it. But if you did check out the 200th episode of Chikara Podcast A Go-Go, I had D'Lo Brown on. I just want to say that was completely my idea. And I'm so thankful that D'Lo was available to do that. Because I was thinking, you know, a lot of people that Mike Quackenbush runs into around the world that are pro wrestlers, they really like the Chikara Podcast A Go-Go. And I mentioned some of these people before, like Great Sasuke, Super Crazy, SEMA, and all these people, you know, they would say things like, I'd love to be on the Chikara Podcast A Go-Go. You know, I like it a lot, or they want to be on it, or something like this. I was sitting in my car as I pulled up to the one Go-Go taping, and I thought, you know what, I know that that D'Lo sometimes works for ROH, which is right in Philly, and I know that TNA is traveling a lot recently and doing house shows and stuff like that. So I just texted him. I said, hey, you know, if you're ever going to be in the around Allentown, let me know, because I'll see if we're going to be taping the Go-Go around that time. Maybe you could come and be on a couple episodes. So he texted me back immediately. Oh, I was still sitting in my car pretty relatively quickly, I think. Yeah, it's hard to remember. It was a little while ago. But I think he did it while I was still sitting in the car. And he said, well, I'm going to be in town next week. And it's like, ah, crap. You know, we're recording this week. We're not going to record again for a little while. So that's kind of unfortuitous. But then I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, maybe if Mike's okay, Mike wasn't at these recordings that we did. So, well, maybe if Mike's okay with it, I can go record a couple episodes in the future and have D'Lo be on them. And so I contacted Quack and he was like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll get together next week, or we could do this next week, or you could do it or whatever, and have him on a 200th episode if he's down with that. I said, okay, I'll find out. So the more I looked into it, it looked like we were going to be able to make it happen. But everything's quite last minute with D'Lo and me and my experiences with him. Because his schedule's kind of hectic and I don't know how planning is on the back end. I have no idea. But I sort of found out that it was going to probably happen on a Friday. And it was going to... it just happened on a Friday. That's all I knew. Because I knew I couldn't get to one place. It was too far away. And then the other place was going to be like within an hour of Allentown. So I said, okay, we'll probably do it Friday. And then I didn't find out until late afternoon that day of when he was going to be in town. And he was only going to be able to have a window of like 2 hours. Yeah, that's what it was. Well, it took an hour to get him from where he was at to where we recorded, and that would be like best time scenario. So I knew he wouldn't be able to come to the studios like was originally planned. So I went there, and that's why we had to find a place. And fortunately, there was a freight elevator and everything, so we got in. But let me tell you, I mean, it was like quick. I didn't even think of any gimmicks. I didn't think of anything. I should have really tried to make something happen with that, but unfortunately, you know, you do what you can. And for the and you can hear that they were testing the sound system in the background. Don West was outside the door on the telephone, so we had to wait for him to stop talking, because you definitely would have been able to hear him. Now, some people may argue that we should have had him on the show, but you know, that may take some doing and some approval to go through. D'Lo's behind the scenes. He got approval for it, so that was okay. And so it was great to have him on, and I love the time that I spend with him. I really, really like this guy. I mean, if I could have thought about it, I would have thought, hey, you know what? I got to get this beret. Maybe we'll do like the Nation of Domination. Bring that back. Do that for I just thought of that now, actually. No, we wouldn't have done that, but that would have been cool. But, you know, I like talking to this guy, and I think he's a very cool fella. And found out a lot more after we were done, after we wrapped. And believe me, like I said, very quick. You know, we opened it up, we went. Opened it up, found the other room, opened up and went. And thankfully, the second part got done, because there was a guy waiting right outside the room to cross in front of us to some other room that had a Coke machine in it or something. And then after the fact, when I was driving home, I realized, oh man, you know, Shelley and Saban probably would have loved to have been on a go-go too, but there was just no time to really set anything up. I didn't see anybody else, and I had a hard enough time just getting in the back door. As a matter of fact, a guy was carrying stuff. I went to the wrong center that they were at. There's two centers with the same name. I went to the wrong one, and I walked several blocks with all my gear. And, you know, it's like a couple bags of stuff, a big backpack and everything else, and like tripods and the cameras and stuff, and all these cables that I will not need, but I bring in just in case. You never know what's going to happen. So, you know, the whole thing was quite running around. So I just got done walking, I don't know how many blocks, with all this gear on me and everything. So for the amount of time it took to do and the amount of time we had to do it and what we were given, I think it came out pretty well. And then, of course, things were changed later with adding the King of Trios update bits into there. So, you know, like I said, for what it was, I think it came out well. But I did find out later afterwards that, I mean, D'Lo Brown and Chikara really share a common history. D'Lo was partners since the time he could backyard wrestle and throw people around with Reckless Youth. He and Reckless were even tag champs, I think, in many different little venues around the place. And he knew Why do I keep thinking that? He knew Don Montoya. He was also pals with them, and they all grew up together. Tom Carter, Reckless Youth, and D-Lo, and Don Montoya. And Don Montoya, Reckless Youth, and Mike Quackenbush started Chikara. They started Chikara. So, but D-Lo, I guess, I don't know where D-Lo was in the mix at the beginning of Chikara. I think he was already, well, yeah, he was probably already in the Fed. Yeah, I guess actually by 2002, D-Lo was far into the WWF. I know he was with Smoky Mountain for a while there, even in the mid-90s, I think. So, I don't know, that was just really neat to find that out. So that's all good. That's all cool. That's about it. The other thing, so this company I'm involved with, this Chikara company, evidently, the Wrestling Observer 2009 awards were in, and Chikara was prominently featured on many of these awards. Quack ranked 7th in Best Technical Wrestler for 2009. He also took 2nd place for Best Booker of 2009, only right behind UFC's Joe Silva. Now, the unique thing about Wrestling Observer is they will say Best Promotion, in which Chikara took 5th place. And their Best Promotion features UFC. UFC's number one for like the past several years. So Best Promotion UFC. Now, what does UFC have to do with wrestling? But I mean, Chikara placed, I think it was like Dragon Gate, New Japan, WWE, and then Chikara was right in there. So if you want to take out UFC, since they have nothing to do with pro wrestling, then... But I guess Observer sees them as a competition for pro wrestling. I don't know. I mean, anything that's going to go head-to-head with wrestling, I would consider competition for pro. So you're going to put, like, American Idol or something against them? I don't know. But that's how they do it, and, you know, that's fine, whatever. Eddie Kingston, so best overall company, 5th place. That's amazing. Beat out many other companies such as ROH and TNA. So that's really something. That's saying something. Eddie Kingston was 5th overall, best in interviews, and he was 10th in the Bruiser Brody Memorial Award for his fact that he's just a good old brawler in the ring there. And Frightmare, though, took number 1 in the Rookie of the Year Award. And he also won the 411 Mania Award for Rookie of the Year. So that's really, really great that Chikara is being recognized by Wrestling Observer. And that would be really cool if it could translate into things like Pro Wrestling Illustrated and that type of thing. But, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's for sure. Hey, everybody. Speaking of Chikara, I better get back to editing here. I've spent the last 3 hours without editing anything for Chikara, only answering a few emails. So, that's my quota. 4 hours not spent doing Chikara work. What will I leave you with here today? I don't know yet. Hold on. I'm just going to cop out. I'm going to leave you with Chikara theme 2008. Take 5. That's the final take that I enjoyed. You know, I should have been working on music all this time. January was supposed to be music. And, you know, I think the only music that happened was the King of Trios 2010 song, which is almost finished, even though I've been using it for the past few shows of the Go-Go. So I'm going to leave you with Chikara theme at 2008. Take 5. And hopefully that will lead into some new music that I will be making and get you jazzed up for that as far as the direction of sound and things. But, you know, don't take that to heart. I still think that my genres will be all over the place and undescribable. And I think that Chikara theme 2008, definitely Chikara theme 2009, really show that that I am bucking concepts of the norm of genre and definitely mixing genres. And that's all I have to say about that. So friends, thank you for joining me in my attempt to express myself that we call a Wiggly World. I'll talk to you soon, A Wiggly World.